Hello, this is Co-Chair Rena Moran. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Select Committee on Racial Justice to order. Venta, do we have a quorum?
Chair Moran, we do have a quorum.
Okay, excellent. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes for October 6, 2020?
So moved.
Who's that? Representative Long moves the minutes from October the 6th, 2020. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. So I want to say welcome members and welcome the public and the testifiers. On July the 20th, the Minnesota House of Representatives passed H.R. 1 off the House floor, declaring racism a public health crisis. Out of that same resolution, the Select Committee on Racial Justice was formed. Today is the third hearing of the Select Committee, in which we open up this committee to hear from the public. Racism is a social system with multiple dimensions. Individual racism is internalized and interpersonal, and systemic racism is institutional or structural, and is a system of structuring opportunities and assigning value based on the social interpretation of how one looks. That unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. It unfairly advantages other individuals and communities, and it saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. And racism causes persistent racial disparities, racial discrimination in housing, education, employment, the criminal justice system, and the environment. And an emerging body of research has demonstrated that racism is a social determinant of health. And so for the members, I would like once again to ask you all to please keep your video on. We do have a long hearing. Our hearing is open from 1 to 10 o'clock. I'm sorry, not that long. From 1 to 4. All right. So I'm just asking members to please take notes. As a preschool teacher, I just say to my kids, you know, put your listening ears on because we have a full agenda and we will not be taking questions from members. To the public, please keep your video off and mute yourself until it is your turn to speak. So if you are not speaking to the testifiers, just turn your video off. We have over 60 people signed up to testify today. So please keep your comments. Please keep all comments to 3 minutes or less. And I do understand when we talk about racism, it is so much that we need to say that need to be heard. But we really want to make sure that each and every person get an opportunity to speak before we end at 4 o'clock. So in saying that, we have 3 minutes or less for you to speak. Staff will state when you have 30 seconds left. So at 2.5 minutes, a staff person will give you a warning that you have 30 seconds left to testify and to wrap it up. And at that time, you know, just please do your best to wrap it up in those 30 seconds. The chair will announce the next 5 people to testify. So we're going to do 5 testifiers at a time. Those testifiers' name will also be located in the chat box, but I will also state who the top 5 testifiers would be to speak next. So also to the public, please keep your eyes on the chat box so that you too can view who the 5 persons are up to testify. When it is your turn to testify, please state your name and your organization for the record before you begin. And please leave the meeting when you are finished. You can watch the hearing via live stream. Links were in the email that you received, as well as on the committee website. So with that, I think we will begin. And so as you can see, if you check into your chat box now, we have a few names here, and it's based on those who we see are currently on the screen. So our first five is Tony Newborn, Michelle Kalfa, Samira Balai Roby, Bernadia Johnson, and Deborah Watts, who will speak first. So if I did not mention your name, could I get all the other testifiers to please turn your video off? And so why don't we start now with Tony Newborn.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I actually, Ms. Deborah Watts will be first. Apologies. There were multiple messages in the chat.
Oh, okay. So Deborah Watts.
So that's Ms. Deborah Watts.
I saw that Deborah Watts was first. So Deborah Watts, please. Introduce yourself, and if you're with an organization, we can't hear you, Deborah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you. First of all, Deborah Watts with the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation, also a resident of Plymouth, Minnesota for the last 32 years, a mother, grandmother, and concerned citizen. And also it brings me great privilege to be a part of this. And I do appreciate the opportunity from this select committee. This is very, very important. And to have the honor and the privilege to speak with you today is such a blessing. I'm standing on the shoulders, though, of those that have gone before me, both in Minnesota and a part of my family. I am a cousin of Emmett Till, who we have experienced great trauma as it relates to his murder in 1955, but also in solidarity with those some 4,000 or so individuals who've been lynched in our country. And then close to home, the families of those that were lynched in Duluth, the McGee, the Clayton families, and others. And then in addition to that, in solidarity with those families, 400 or so families that have experienced police violence. So we're talking about a long history of violence, racism, that has been at the hands of those that have brought hate and violence into our midst. And so it gives me great privilege to talk about how we need to move forward. This is a country, a state, that I don't believe that the current situation is something that we can rest on. So this opportunity to speak about the public health issues that we face and the number of families that have experienced trauma as it relates to the lynchings, the murders, and the police violence is very critical. I have been advocating on the behalf of families of victims of racially motivated murders at a national level and have proposed some solutions on a national level as well. And they involve having a seat at the table when we're talking about policy.
Excuse me, 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. Thank you. When we talk about the policies. And then in addition to that, on a state level in Minnesota, we have received language for a bill and an act that's called the Emmett Lewis Till Victims Recovery Program. And that involves trauma-informed training from a cultural, faith-based, specific opportunity to advance healing to those families of those victims. They usually are left out of the solution. And having an opportunity to speak, having an opportunity to provide voice, and to bring reality to the trauma and the need for a public health response to this situation is very necessary. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I'd love to have the opportunity in the future to talk more specifically about the bill, the Emmett Lewis Till Victims Recovery Program, and how that will affect and impact the health, healing, and wellness of those families here in Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Ms. Deborah Watts. We appreciate having you here. You know, I think we all know the legacy of Emmett Till's And so, you know, our hearts continue to go up to you and the family as you deal with this legacy and how to correct some of the wrongs. So our next speaker would be Latricia Vitoc will be next, and after Patricia, I'm not sure if it's Latricia and Tony Newborn are together, but I have Latricia next. So go ahead, Ms. Vitoc.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Latricia Vitoc, and I'm the Director of Health Policy and Advocacy at North Point Health and Wellness Center in North Minneapolis. I also serve as a Minneapolis Parks Commissioner. I'm representing Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation, a coalition of 60-plus organizations preventing youth tobacco addiction. I also co-chair the Menthol Coalition, a group fighting the specific problem of menthol tobacco, especially in the Black community. I want to thank you for creating this committee to address systemic institutionalized racism faced by Black Minnesotans, as well as Indigenous people and other communities of color. Racism is a public health crisis. One huge step we can take to address this crisis is ending sales of menthol tobacco products. Menthol is a cooling chemical that makes it easier to start smoking, easier to inhale, and harder to quit. For decades, Big Tobacco has marketed menthol cigarettes specifically to African-American people, advertising in Black publications and neighborhoods, sponsoring concerts. They even used to drive around Black neighborhoods handing out free samples of menthol cigarettes. Today, 88% of Black smokers smoke menthols. So it is any wonder why African Americans have the highest death rate and shortest survival rate for the most cancers. Also, Black people are 53% more likely to die from heart disease, the top smoking-related disease. Now, research shows many Black smokers say if menthol were banned, they quit altogether. Yet again and again, menthol gets exempted from flavor policies. For example, since the federal government restricted certain fruit and candy e-cigs, menthol e-cigarette use is soaring. Today, 30% of high school vapers use menthol e-cigs, and menthol products now account for half of all e-cigarette sales. Of course, Black people aren't the only ones hurt by menthol products. They're popular among all demographics, kids, Latinx, LGBTQ, and yes, even white straight people. We can't let the tobacco industry continue addicting and harming the next generation. Our coalition has worked to pass local policies to build momentum for a statewide law. A few weeks ago, Fridley became the 17th Minnesota community to restrict flavor sales.
30 seconds.
Five Minnesota cities have completely prohibited the sale of flavored tobacco product. Now, the biggest difference would be a strong federal ban on menthol, but our health can't wait for the FDA. Earlier this year, a bill to take flavored tobacco products off the market cleared the committee process in the Minnesota House. In 2021, let's expand our bipartisan coalition to protect the health of all Minnesotans from all flavored tobacco products, especially menthol. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Latricia Vitoc. Appreciate it. And I'm sorry, I was just reading through the chats that I was to have Reverend Miller to go next. So why don't we have Reverend Miller to go next, and then Tony Newborn, you will follow Reverend Miller. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Melvin, Reverend Melvin Miller. I'm senior pastor at Progressive Baptist Church, and certainly want to thank the House Select Committee for this opportunity to share today. I want to just, it takes a minute for a preacher to get going, but I'm going to jump right into it. We have some significant crises in the African American community around health issues and health concerns. You name it across the board, whether it be diabetes or whether it be heart disease, it was just mentioned, we have some significant challenges. And I'm, as a pastor, I'm in the heart of it, in the middle of it. I've done literally four funerals, in the last month and a half, less than that. And some of it's COVID related, some of it is cancer related, and on and on and on. These are challenges and health disparities that are front and center as relates to African American community, African American leaders. We see it every single day, and the challenges are certainly connected to systemic racism. My mother in Jackson, Mississippi, stems back well before the 1940s, when she'd have to go to the dentist in the back door, and they would pull her teeth instead of actually filling her teeth. What I'm saying here is, there are a number of challenges that we have in the community, and the church can play and has always played a very significant role in bringing about change. And this is, it's no different as it relates to population health. We have a significant role. In fact, this is evidence-based. We can, I think with the right partnerships, with the Department of Health, with hospitals, and with our right resources, we can bring about change in health concerns and health issues in African American community. This is evidence-based. And I want to just say a couple of things about that. And I'm rushing here. And it is critical. As we think about the challenges that are facing the African-American community, that we work together to bring about these changes. Over 50% of the social determinants of health are socioeconomic. And we have been in the center of that, attempting to bring about change and bring about the critical, bringing together healthcare workers for here at the church. We've been doing diabetes prevention, the menthol tobacco.
30 seconds.
And so what I'm saying here is the evidence suggests that trusted institutions like the church, specifically the church, who's been at front and center in the fight for social justice for decades. And so I want to just say that the church is there to play a significant role and to renew the trust. See, the big challenge has been in the African American community is that there has no, the trust has been destroyed as relates to
time.
Trusting in healthcare community. We can restore that trust is what I'm trying to get at. So thank you. And thank you for this opportunity.
And thank you, Reverend Miller. Appreciate hearing your voice today. Okay, so we have Tony Newborn and then Michelle Kaufer. Maybe. And please apologize. I apologize if I mispronounce anyone's name. I'm notorious for that. Don't take it personal. I don't mean to do it. So please go ahead, Tony.
Great. And good afternoon, everyone. Tony Newborn, pronouns she, her, hers. I serve as the Chief Equity Officer for the City of St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of our Mayor, Melvin McCarter. And thank you so much for having me here. We were asked to provide an update on the city's racial equity work and around since, the happening of COVID-19. So as you all may know, the city has an equity framework which involves and includes our city departments, in which each of our departments strive towards a work plan and work goals to ensure that equity is viewed and through every lens, that all of our work is viewed through an equity lens. And so we have that structure internally within the city, and that includes our engagement efforts, it includes our policies, practices, and procedures and training. As it relates to some of the citywide initiatives that we've done that are a little bit more external focus, we've had, and you all may be familiar with the work that the mayor has led around our Bridge Fund, which was developed shortly in the spring of this year, and shortly after COVID hit, really the city of St. Paul, and we started to work remotely and see the impact that was happening and across our city. As you all may know, we had close to a little over 7,000 applications, and a little over 1,200 families were awarded a grant.
And so this was the huge, source of funding for our families and our businesses here and businesses of color and families of color throughout the city of St. Paul. We also have recently launched a prosperity project, which is a guaranteed income pilot, which is led by the Office of Financial Empowerment. The People's Prosperity Pilot will provide up to 150 St. Paul families with $500 per month in guaranteed income for a period of up to 18 months. So this project was launched not too long ago, less than a month. We're really excited about that, and we know that this is going to be of support for our families here in the city of St. Paul. As a result of COVID, we stood up, and as a part of our racial equity framework, we stood up what we call a COVID-19
30 seconds.
Racial equity work group. And this group is comprised of staff and community members, in which we wanted to build a coalition of some sort around our public health needs, how do we organize around legislative advocacy, community engagement, as well as economic justice. And I'm happy to report that we were able to work with our community partners and community clinics and healthcare providers such as MinCare and Open Cities, as well as Ramsey County in the state of Minnesota, on standing up a public health work group. And this group is focused on access to testing, access to PPE, and also community and cultural specific communication. So we've been working really closely with that group and are proud to move forward with working with our community as well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Newborn. For the testifiers who have testified and for those who are not testifying, we have asked that you turn your cameras off until it's your turn to speak. Thank you for that. Ms. Kofa, you can say name for it, Michelle. And after you will be Samira Vallarobi. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Kofa, and I'm the policy manager at Allies, an advocacy organization that works to advance educational equity and remove barriers so all Minnesota students can receive a rigorous and engaging education. As this committee seeks to address issues of racial justice in our state, we see education as an area that needs laser focus. For years, Minnesota has had startling opportunity and achievement gaps, and now more than ever, the gaps and racial inequities in our state's education system needs to be addressed. Moving into the 2021 legislative session, we hope that this committee will use its influence to push policies that will benefit our students of color and reform our inherently racist education system. To start, we must have a bold approach to recruiting and retaining teachers of color. Research shows that when students of color have teachers of color, they're more likely to be placed in gifted programs, graduate from high school on time, feel more cared for, and are less likely to be pushed out of school through exclusionary discipline. To diversify the teacher workforce, this committee should support preserving pathways to tiered licensure and allowing school leaders to hire new teachers based on their effectiveness. This committee should also support investments in alternative teacher certification programs that recruit more diverse teachers. The committee must also support policies that dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. We must put an end to unfair and sometimes violent disciplinary practices that disproportionately impact students of color and push them into the criminal justice system. Minnesota's history of disproportionately suspending and expelling students of color is extensively documented. Black students are 8 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers, and Native American students are 10 times more likely, often for the same infractions. Lastly, but certainly not least, this committee must work to protect the self-determination of students and families of color. This committee must protect the rights of parents to choose the best schools for their students. Efforts to shut down charter schools that are working for students of color and Native American students restrict the autonomy of families. Policymakers should stand up to defend what's working while ensuring all schools are held accountable to the families that they serve. Racial justice must begin in our schools. In order to create a society that is anti-racist and equity-focused, we must begin with our education system, removing systemic and racist barriers that stand in the way of students receiving a rigorous education. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee.
And thank you so much for being here today. So we have Samira, and after Samira, we have Bernadia Johnson. Ms. Roby.
Thank you, representatives, for allowing me to speak before you today. My name is Samira Bilal Roby. I'm the director of the Waldo African American Babies Coalition and Projects and Integrated Care High Risk Pregnancy Initiative. I'm a third generation Minnesota, unable to recognize the Minnesota I was raised in. Yes, there was always prejudice and discrimination, but now that empathy is being drowned out. It feels like those that often were my allies are no longer significantly heard to scale the energy needed for human rights. I believe it necessary to define awareness on what triggers inappropriate actions, such as racist behaviors through daily life and policies. It is imperative to examine this frequently. Disturbing messages in a lifetime of bigotry with no accountability decays emotional intelligence and stops positive community influences. In the United States, the caste system called racism, placing the Jim Crow system, which are brothers, is able to bear its beasts. Characterization based through a caste system is to nullify cultural identity and executing human invisibility is detrimental for any forward-moving society. Humbly, my expertise is to focus on the social development of children's self-worth so they are healthy during their endless educational growth. Don't we all want those youngsters to feel kindly, be fair, and share by playing with others? This parents and teachers say so they grow up to contribute as an adult respecting relations and become good leaders and neighbors that are just and fair-minded. Now, I will connect the parallel of adult continual development. We must continually examine our cultural lens many times over by progressing in our individual growth. Will you reject indignities that are designed to provide the lack of housing, medical care, and equitable economics so our community can thrive comfortably? I would like today to draw some strategies for assessing this honestly and reflecting on those desirable qualities we demand of our youngsters. Will you, as our partner in government, help families by enacting legislation to institute the Family Leave Pay Act to allow fathers, especially single fathers, nurturing and caring for their babies in the early weeks of birth? Please stay mindful that all these children are Minnesota's future workforce. All mothers receive relevant
30 seconds
to deliver healthy infants, particularly when there is crisis in the African-American community and Indigenous community. But I'm so sorry, I have asthma. Equal and balanced education and housing policies that close the economic and education disorders, address toxic syndrome, stress syndrome. I'm rushing through this. And so I want to go back to with the mothers that we need our doulas
to be
there. And Minnesotans should not fear any discussion on race and equity, but hold compassion as our guiding force towards justice. This is not un-American. The reality is race is man-made, fabricated system, addressing its effects on the human spirit, promises truth to transformation. The outcry in the national community is without equity, there's no equality. Please invest in our people of color, indigenous to marginalized communities to end the untruths that keep us divided through systemic and cooperative racism.
Thank you, Ms. Roby. Glad you were able to testify and made it through that.
I did. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Bernadia Johnson, I see you on the screen. We were all prepared to do your voice message that you left with us. Which do you prefer? Because I now don't see you. Oh, there you go. Yeah, so which do you prefer? Would you prefer to speak?
I prefer to speak, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am so happy to be here today as a former superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, as well as the current assistant professor at Minnesota State University in Mankato. And I'm happy to realize that you guys are recognizing the systems that are designed to get the results that they get, and K-12 is no exception from that. Over 30 years ago, a similar program was recognized, a similar need was recognized by a committee such as yourself, and created what was called the Collaborative Urban Educator Program. That particular program took people of color from industry and took them through a alternative licensure program and placed them in Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools. So I was one of those individuals who went through an alternative licensure program in the state of Minnesota and taught initially in St. Paul public schools, then became an administrator in St. Paul, and then became a principal in Minneapolis, a deputy superintendent in Memphis, and came back here to be the superintendent in Minneapolis. So I'm excited, and I'm here representing the children and as a constituency base in the state of Minnesota. What we know is that our students need diversity. We need the diverse people in front of our students because of the power that they bring. They bring not only their experience and their lived experience and their education and knowledge in an opportunity to help educate our children to the highest level. And what we know about the need for people of color, we see fewer disparities than we see now in those classrooms. And to give you an example of why I know this for a fact because as a superintendent of Minneapolis, twice a month, I looked at every suspension, for example, across the entire district. And I saw the disparities and the discrepancies in how students were treated for one behavior, the behavior that was the same for a white student and a black student. And those, to me, create disparities and it socialized students to feel like school is not a place for them. And if you do that, then you start to have this socialized behavior that if school is not a place for me, then why would I stay there? And it's also connected to academic achievement. I was able to pull data and look at data to understand that if a student missed 8 days of school, it had an adverse impact on their mathematics instruction. Because guess what? Mathematics is consequential in learning the skills, as well as the fact that the teachers were absent. That created more.
30 seconds.
But I can also tell you, as a superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, that it's not enough to recruit teachers of color, which we were able to do in Minneapolis. What was the problem is the retention. And retention becomes a problem because the last in, first out. So all the investment and resources we put into recruiting these teachers to come into our schools, it gets lost because they can't stay. And then what happens is, and I'm happy for my suburban superintendents, they would, you know, take these teachers up and keep them. And so as you can see what happened with the Minnesota Teacher of the Year. That's happening. So I ask that you try to dismantle all the systemic issues that we have out there that impact our children of color. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Mrs. Johnson. And thank you for your work in the educational arena for so many years. I just want to also state for those who have testified, because we are looking for recommendations that come from the public. So if you feel a need to, please, maybe why don't you email, I think it was Benta, those recommendations so that we can begin to look at and compile a list that can be shared with us legislatively and throughout the state. Right? Thank you. So Dr. Ruth Charles, good to see you here. And then we have Shariz Jatoff is next. And please, I want you to clear your name up for me, please, Shariz. Mrs. Dr. Charles. We can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
That's better.
I'm Ruth Charles, she, her, hers, professor of social work at Winona State University, also community organizer with Resilient Winona County. Thank you to the chairs for holding this meeting and opening it up to the public. Also, your colleague, Representative Jean Pawlowski, is my neighbor and wanted me to remind you that I spoke at both the House Human Service Policy and the House Ways and Means Committee when you had your special session here in Winona.
Yes.
I'm here to speak for the children and to remind you that addressing this issue is not rocket science, it's neuroscience. We need to pay attention to the brain development of our young children during this time of racial unrest, and we need to pay attention to what this means. I want to tell you about my nephew, who's 12 years old and is biracial. He doesn't live in Minnesota, but he lives in a northern state in a rural area near the Canadian border. Next to his house is a local fire station, and there are police, border control, and other officials stopping by. His family doesn't really watch the news, but they did hear about George Floyd's murder, which was really upsetting to them. When asked if my nephew wanted to go to a peaceful protest and see the people that supported him, he was distraught and couldn't think of going. What if someone there didn't want to see me? A few days later, my nephew was playing outside when a Border Patrol car passed his house. My nephew waved at the officer, but the officer didn't recognize him. Both parents were there, and as he cried about this, he said that often he waves at the officers, but they don't recognize him. His parents and other adults were there to talk him through the event, and he was surrounded by loving, caring adults who could help him process the stressful time. When a child experiences stress, negative or toxic stress, the hormone cortisol flows through a child's body. Normally, 20 minutes is okay, but when it goes on day after day, week after week, it can cause damage to the developing brain. It can make the limbic system, which is the fight, flight, or freeze part of the brain, go into overdrive. Instead of being able to connect through logic or facts, the emotions take over. When a child doesn't feel safe, biologically, the child might run, might fight, or withdraw. Brains are built through experiences, good or bad, and we need to work on giving incredible experiences, especially through our educational system, to all children, but especially to children of color who continue to face adversity for no reason other than the color of their skin. We know what toxic stress does to children's brains. We need to be preventative and proactive. I need to tell you the end of the story because it does have a happy one. After the family finished talking with my nephew about the event, the officer pulled up in his car. He had Oreos for the kids and said that his mind was off somewhere else when my nephew waved. My nephew's waving brought him back to reality, and he wanted to recognize the positive influence that my nephew had. All children need to have the healing and support that my nephew had, both from his family and from the community. How are we portraying this to the children where we live?
Time.
Are we making them feel love and welcome? This impacts their brain growth, and it's neuroscience that we need to address. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Childs, and thank you for, I do remember, of course, you know, I remember you and Winona, but I know you best for your work around ACEs and what you're doing at Winona College. So I just want to say thank you for that work and just reminding us that kids are impacted by negative interactions, and it is embedded in the brain. It's neurological. So thank you for your work. Is it Shia Rice?
It's okay. Charisse. Yes, hi.
It's Charisse. Okay, Charisse. Thanks. Sorry about that. Pronounce your last name, please.
Charisse. Jetto.
Jetto. All
yes.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for having me here on this platform. My name is Charisse Jetto, property manager of Higher Ground Minneapolis Residential Housing for Catholic Charities of St. Paul, Minneapolis. I'm a property manager there who houses long-term homeless and chronic homeless population. And my job there is to just make sure that we have a healthy community and a safe environment for them. Catholic Charities serves nearly 23,000 children, families, and adults over the course of the year. Last year alone, we provided over 1.2 million meals and nearly 6,000 nights of supportive housing and emergency shelter. Over 70% of the people we serve are people of color. The Select Committee has discussed at length the inequities experienced by people of color in Minnesota. Those inequities are very much representative in our housing sites and in our shelters. And those inequities often lead to people being our clients in the first place. As a property manager, I've reviewed countless housing applications from people with extremely challenging histories and deep needs for mental health and chemical dependencies, and many other challenges. People rent apartments from us because we try to provide the other help needed for them to be able to keep stable housing. Once I just received an application from a young lady who was in need of an apartment, and I was immediately surprised that she would be applying at Catholic Charities. Her application shown like 9 years of work history at the same employer in the suburbs. She had 8 years of good rental history at the same apartment. I ran her background study, and literally she had nothing on her background that reflected why she shouldn't have been housed. While interviewing this young lady, I learned that she had applied for Catholic Charities because of the low barriers that we offer. Excuse me. She was facing homelessness, and she had to recently end her relationship. So that was requiring her to move because she couldn't afford the place that she was currently staying in. She had applied at numerous other apartment complexes in the suburbs She preferred those locations due to where she was employed. And she was repeatedly denied, typically because her credit score wasn't high enough. At the time, her credit score was like 500 or so. Not perfect, but with such strong rental history, you would think that she would have been able to pass without without the having, you know, the credit score. She had clear rental history. She had the clear employment and was able to afford those places. She did get accepted in some locations, but she didn't feel very safe in those locations. So
that's fine.
I want to thank you all for letting me have this opportunity to be on this platform. You have a wonderful day.
All right. Thank you so much, Cerise, for joining us today. I appreciate your testimony. So Tanya Allen, and then after Tanya Allen, we have Mitchell Davis.
Thank you. My name is Tanya Allen. I'm the Director of Mental Health and Family Engagement for Intermediate District 287. Thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm here to express my concerns and advocate for change related to historical trauma. Earlier this year, I had the opportunity to testify before based on my experiences as a principal. Since then, our nation has been in the midst of a pandemic, and families, significantly those that are Black and Brown, have been impacted the most in their daily lives. Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, that plague communities of color have intensified due to the murder of George Floyd locally and many more murders nationally. Our children are watching. In addition to the racial unrest, we have had peaceful marches that turned into violent conflicts. Once again, our children are watching. In Minnesota, our reality for the impact on our children of color is stark. It is clear that although there are changes to the law, changes in practice have not followed. According to Wilder research using the Professional Education Labor Standards Board data from the 2017-18 school year, 95.7% of licensed staff, not just teachers, in Minnesota are white. The same research shows that 33.5% of children served in our schools are students of color. Our children deserve to see people in their schools that look like them and can understand their experiences. Yet in Minnesota, we still have not made systemic changes to ensure that teachers of color are not the first out the door. You may wonder what this has to do with historical trauma and adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. The Center for Disease Control recognizes strategies to prevent or counteract ACEs. Two strategies relevant to the lack of teachers of color are connecting youth to caring adults and helping students have a good start. Research has demonstrated that teachers of color have high expectations of students of color, develop caring and trusting relationships with their students, and confront racism through teaching. Legislators are chosen and provided the responsibility by the people of addressing change that benefits all. I hope that legislators look at what is happening throughout the state of Minnesota to begin to address the systemic inequities that exist, such as access to technology during this pandemic, and increase opportunity gaps for students of color that we have today. We have an imperative to address the impact on mental health and trauma on our children. Dr. Joy Bradford, a psychologist, has said racism can result in a host of concerns, including things like increased anxiety and symptoms of depression. We need to examine our priorities to include providing educators the resources to address racial equity and understand and respond to the historical trauma that has impacted our children. Thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it. So we have Mitchell Davis, Cassandra Holmes, and then Ben McKay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mitchell Davis, business owner, faith leader, and also chair of the Hennepin County Healthcare Systems Community Advisory Board. This board serves as a catalyst for relationship building, partners with community organizations, and also listens to populations with unmet health needs, business community, and especially our families who live in the community. Now, racial justice is a matter that concerns me personally and professionally. As an African-American male, I belong to a group of people who have been among the most severely affected by health disparities impacting diabetes, cancer, health disease, asthma, violence, police brutality, and now COVID-19. As a health professional, I'm also distressed, disheartened, and disturbed to witness unmet needs, healthcare needs in our society. And racism, I believe, is a fundamental cause of adverse health outcomes for racial, ethnic inequities in health. In 1751, Benjamin Franklin and Dr. Bond created the nation's first public hospital called the Pennsylvania Hospital, and they established the promotion of public health as a core American value. Non-white U.S. citizens did not benefit much at all from this system created over 270 years ago. Under President Barack Obama, the Affordable Care Act cemented health care as a fundamental right for all Americans. And today, no individual can be denied coverage for health care because of pre-existing conditions. And all U.S. citizens need and must resist all efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. People's lives matter more than politics. I'm going to say it again. People's lives matter more than politics. Racial justice demands that we enhance our understanding of the complex ways in which socioeconomic status, race, stress, racism, health behavior, and religion involvement can affect health and develop models of care. Recommendations. The Hennepin County Healthcare Basic Needs Survey highlights the COVID-19 impact, and they serve over 60% patients who are non-white and 20% prefer a language other than English. I recommend that you examine racial justice through the lens of access to care, the cost of services, and the quality of care that patients experience within the healthcare system. Also, that the University of Minnesota School of Public Health strengthen their outreach to historically Black
college
university students. I want to congratulate the Minnesota House Select Committee on Racial Justice for your resolve to prepare and establish a new narrative at the intersection of medical research, private systems innovation, and community and state government action, which can serve as a recipe in healing our state and even our nation's racial justice framework. In conclusion, W.E.B. Du Bois, in his study, The Philadelphia Negro, in 1899, observed that the most difficult problem in improving Black health was the attitude, which was, there have been few cases in history of civilized people where human suffering has been viewed with such peculiar indifference. Today, there is no place for this peculiar indifference in modern healthcare. So racial justice must be realized. Like the right to vote, healthcare is a fundamental
overtime
that must be promoted. Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and humane, as Dr. Martin Luther King says. Thank you. I'm appreciative for this moment to testify.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your information. So we have Cassandra Holmes and then Ben McKay.
Hello, Miigwech, Madam Chair and board members, our chair members. Buju, Niwe Makwa Ikwe Indigenous Cause, Makwa Indodeam. I'm saying hello. My name is Four Bears Woman. I am Bear Clan, but I'm also known as Cassandra Holmes. I am a member of the Great Ojibwe Nation. I also sit on the East Phillips Improvement Coalition, EPIC, and the East Phillips Neighborhood Institute, EPNI. I am a resident of the Little Earth of United Tribes in the East Phillips neighborhood and have been for most of my life. I have suffered great loss due to racial and environmental justices that have caused severe health concerns in my family. My own son, Trinidad, lost his life to an unexpected heart issue that came about at the age of 14. He lived to be only 16 years old. Not only my own family, but the community has suffered. I have neighborhood friends who have lost children to unknown heart conditions and asthma. Little Earth is unique in that we are the only Indian preference urban housing in the country. And right at the moment, we represent 38 different tribes. And I believe that we are suffering from forms of genocide by way of our city council and public works who are not listening to us community members. We have had eminent domain used against us for the property of the Roof Depot site in the East Phillips to bring a business that will bring more traffic, more pollution, as opposed to our community plan that will bring green jobs, green education, solar panels, and low-income housing. Imagine being asked if you want clean water or clean air. That is a question I was asked by a city council member. Change in our water is not part of the city's plan, but the pollution, bringing more pollution is. But why is that even a question? I shouldn't even have to answer that. Indigenous urban people on a bigger scale than imagine are being dumped on by our own elected officials. Imagine, this is not just one tribe in one area. These are 38 different tribal members that live here that are being affected. And that's not even including the rest of the East Phillips community. And Little Earth has about 500 miners that live on property. This will not only hurt us now, but our children years from now. And East Phillips, we can't take no more, and we are at our limit. Please help and listen to the community members in our needs. We live in a Southside Green Zone and what is also known as the Arsenic Circle. We want green jobs, green education, food security, and opportunities. We want to breathe, and as Indigenous people, we want to exist. We are here, and we need people to acknowledge that. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you so much, Casey Holmes. And we want clean water and clean air. It's not an or. Okay, Mr. Mackay.
Thank you, Representative Moran. My name is Benjamin Mackay. I represent African American Registry's Teachers Forum. The mission of the registry is to increase understanding through education and to raise self-esteem through knowledge. We've been established for 21 years. We focus on the fact that youth lives matter. Let me bring that into focus. Next month, the post-9/11 children will vote in our national election for the very first time in their lives. These future leaders have been raised in a world of opportunities that also requires more clarity. Millennial normal includes being at war in your country, having a Black president, environmental concerns, LGBT friends, wealth disparities, generation differences, abortion as a choice, and much, much more. African American Registry's Teachers Forum was founded to respect youth through curriculum reform and integrate all of those issues into all subjects at all grade levels. In 2017, we had a bill passed with the state legislature to put our Teachers Forum in front of 700 students in teacher education departments at the University of St. Thomas and Metro State University Schools of Education and Urban Education, respectively. Part of the bill required us to have an assessment of accountability through data and testimonies in the library of the Senate building every January. Those two assessments are available for the public to review, and they speak to the kind of support that the Association of American Colleges and Universities has been saying since 2014, and that is that culturally relevant content is the main game changer that can help all children get to the place that they need to be. That being said, we have another bill currently in the legislative session that hopefully will be there available after the bonding measure gets taken care of in this fifth special session. That is for the second phase of the Teachers Forum, which is our readability learning system. Technology is the driving force that has taken the agrarian culture and the industrial culture.
30 seconds.
Century. That piece is accessed through the readability learning system. On that note, I want to thank the committee and thank you, Representative Moran, for having African American Registry's Teachers Forum available to this esteemed group today. I will put a link to our Teachers Forum in the chat.
Absolutely. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mackay. Appreciate the work that you're doing. So I just want to remind testifiers, it's also been put up in the chat that once you have testified, if you can click the leave meeting button and feel free to continue watching on the live stream. You can just click on the link here inside the chat and it would take you there. Our next speaker is Rico Alexander, and then Akamiri. Sharira. I probably did not pronounce that as it correctly, but Mr. Alexander.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rico Alexander. I'm the Head Start, Early Head Start Director for Parents and Community Action, also referred to as PICA. At PICA, we provide services to over 2,500 low-income Head Start and Early Head Start prenatal and homeless children and their families at 13 different locations throughout Hennepin County. There are also an additional 32 Head Start programs across the state that serve an additional 12,000 children and their families. My goal today is to share with you how Head Start programs have had an impact on the lives of low-income people and people of color from around the state, and how Head Start has supported racial justice, as well as how the program has always been there for folks that have been most affected by racial injustice. PICA itself was founded by concerned parents, Head Start parents, over 50 years ago. And while Head Start and PICA have both seen tremendous growth and seen significant changes over the years, the one thing that remains constant is that Head Start promotes racial equality and justice in everything that we do. And we aim to close the gap by supporting children and families as they strive to overcome the impact of racial injustice and seek to achieve their full potential in school, in the workplace, and in their communities. Most people know that Head Start offers early childhood education for young children. Many people don't know, however, that we provide comprehensive services to support children and preparing them to succeed in school and to help their parents achieve economic self-sufficiency. In addition to early childhood education, Head Start always provides health, dental, and mental health services, services for children with disabilities, nutrition services, social services, transportation, and parent involvement opportunities. Many of our families face language and cultural barriers to accessing the services they need, and families are often impacted by trauma as well in the form of poverty, homelessness, mental illness, and the like. Head Start's comprehensive approach to service delivery has helped mitigate the effects of trauma on families, empowers them to advocate for themselves and to seek out the resources that they need. But even fewer people know that Head Start provides workforce development programs for parents, the majority of whom are people of color, that help them acquire the knowledge, the skills, and the hands-on experience needed to secure employment. At PICA, for example, over 50% of our staff are comprised of our current or former Head Start parents, many of whom obtain their training at PICA and advanced receive a college degree supported and paid for by PICA. What Head Start does is create a culture that helps to attract, retain, and motivate high qualified teachers of color. And even more importantly, we provide opportunities to low-income families, low-income people of color, who often have limited access to such opportunities. You know, there isn't enough time for me to tell you everything that Head Start does or have done for low-income families or people of color. Hopefully this brief overview has glimpse of helping children. And I just want you to know that Head Start takes a strong stance against racial injustice. And amidst a devastating series of events in our communities that we serve, we stand strong with our Head Start families and our families work together to support, strengthen, and rebuild our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Alexander. I'd like to say the legislature is a strong advocate of Head Start pre-K early learning. And we know the important role it plays in getting kids prepared to move into a kindergarten reading by third grade. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Agnew, I hope you pronounce your name for me. And it's then okay. After that, Paula Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives and the Minnesota community. I am Akmiri Sakara, and I work for the Cultural Wellness Center. And we unleash the power of citizens to heal themselves and build, connect back to their community by using health. The loss of culture, isolation, and connection to community makes you sick. And as a cultural people, we are really working at that at this point in time. I am a doula, and I've been a doula for 30 years here in this community. I was really the first African-American doula for a long time, really working in the community. And I believe I work with families who are birthing. And so being culturally insensitive is hurting and damaging our youngest Minnesotans. When people move through our systems of helping hands, supposedly, they are treated poor and unfairly, and it's killing us. We owe it to them to work toward acknowledging, supporting, and being culturally sensitive to the needs of individuals that will keep them safe. That's really what I wanted you to know. So I want you to keep our people safe. All right. Yes. Thank you very much for this time.
And thank you for your work, and thank you for the work that you're doing as a doula. Crucially important. Ms. Coles. Ms. Coles, and then Alina, maybe? Alina Mija? Paula Coles, please. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Moran, Chair Richardson, and all members of the Selected Committee for Racial Justice. My name is Paula Cole. I am an immigrant raising biracial children, and I'm very passionate about racial justice. I'm a former public school teacher, and currently I am the executive director at Educators for Excellence Minnesota. E4 is an organization that supports teachers in their wish to advocate for education policies that improve education outcomes for all students. I apologize in advance for my dog, who barks at anything that goes outside. Sorry about that. I am also an elected member of the Richie Board of Education. Racial injustice in our state is noticeable in all areas of life, but I'm here today to talk about education inequity in our state. Statistically speaking, if you are a Black, Latino, or Indigenous parent, you could have not picked the worst place to live if you want your child to graduate from high school. Our students of color continue to fall behind this year because of structural racism and individual prejudice that leads to low expectation, discipline disparities, and lack of differentiated set of resources to support our students and their families. After my statement, many of you are going to say, well, we're already doing these things, but my ask to you today is that you please evaluate if existing measures are reaching the intended outcomes. First, funding. Throwing money at the problem alone is one example. I'm not saying that that's what you're doing, but unfortunately, it happens a lot. Equitable funding is only equitable if it's allocated where it is most needed. Meaningful resource allocation is one critical part of moving the needle for students who are most shortchanged by our current system. Teachers of color, please continue to work on recruitment and retention of teachers of color. Teacher retention in general is a problem, but keeping teachers of color with less seniority in our schools continues to be a challenge. We also need more teacher preparation program alternatives. Many people of color who wish to become teachers cannot afford unpaid student teaching requirements. Our teacher prep programs also need to do a better job at preparing white teacher candidates to lead classrooms in a culturally responsive manner. The normative culture of students sitting in rows and columns is not culturally relevant to most cultures. This difference results in disparities. For example, suspensions or students who are asked to leave the classroom, even now in the world of distance learning. Teachers of color have often been the victim of low expectations, and as such, they are more likely to have higher
expectations
for their own students. Finally, COVID time. Please consider the devastating effect that the pandemic is having on already struggling students, such as access to technology, language and technology barrier, and access to differentiated instruction or homework support, to name a few examples. Thank you very much for your time, Madam Chairs and committee members, for giving me this opportunity and really for being part of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cole. You gave us a lot of things to think about. I'm hoping you can also submit that to us so that we can have it for the record. Thank you. We have up next is it Ilana? And Vijamula is after Ilana.
Hi, thank you all for allowing me to be here to provide testimony on such an important issue. I appreciate this committee and the work that you do. Knowing that I can't fit my remarks in 3 minutes, I'll ask the committee administrator to include my full remarks in the committee record. My name is Ileana Mejia. I use pronouns, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Council of Nonprofits. I also serve as co-chair for the Racial Equity and Joy Coalition. Minnesota Council of Nonprofits is the largest statewide association of nonprofits in the country, representing over 2,200 member organizations across the state. Minnesota has one of the strongest nonprofit sectors in the nation, and as we work to address problems perpetuated by disparities in the equities of our society, nonprofits must recognize our own responsibility and history in relation to our current realities of structural racism. This includes ensuring nonprofits have the tools and resources to make changes within their own organization and the sector to advance diversity, equity, and inclusion, in recognizing and learning from those leading the way in this work. MCN is working with our member nonprofits and internally to confront racism in our sector and our individual organizations, and we look to the legislature to do the same. Nonprofits alone can't remake the world. That work will take the entire community. Minnesota, as we all have been hearing, is one of the worst states in the nation for Black, Indigenous, and people of color to live in. We have the highest disparities. We have the highest disparity rates in terms of housing, education, income, incarceration, and home ownership. This didn't happen by accident. These disparities happen due to racist policies that impact Black and brown people more than white people. The Minnesota State Legislature is one of the most important and powerful decision-making bodies in Minnesota. You have a unique power to pass equitable and just policies to help address these horrific disparities. We urge members of this committee and all legislators to center racial equity in your work. Racial equity should not be an afterthought after one drafts a bill. It needs to be at the forefront of every policy that is put forth. You should constantly be asking yourself if a policy is anti-racist or racist. If legislators are not sure what anti-racist is, I recommend you read Dr. Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Dr. Kendi says that you can't eliminate racial inequities unless you acknowledge and eliminate racist policies. Simply put, to be an anti-racist is to support policies that lead to equity and justice. While there are many other brilliant, great sources to learn from, Dr. Kendi is just one example on how
30 seconds.
In your anti-racism work. Minnesota can be a leader in the nation in addressing racial disparities, or we can continue to be a leader in having the worst racial disparities. This work will take dedication and commitment from all members of the Minnesota State Legislature, and I ask all of you to help make Minnesota a place where everyone can thrive and be proud of the state they call home. Thank you, Chair Moran and the committee, and I look forward to collaborating with you in the future.
Thank you so much for your testimony. John? Mula?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Yes.
My name is Vajong Moore, and I'm the Director of Racial and Health Equity Advocacy at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm also former chair of the Cultural Ethnic Communities Leadership Council, and proudly arrived in this country as a Hmong refugee. Previous speakers and previous hearings have already illuminated how core, how central structural racism is to the creation of racial and health inequities. So I'm not going to spend my time on that. I think the case is airtight. It is profoundly obvious. And our scientific community and our ancestors, many of the people who spoke today, confirmed that. I want to shift my comments to what can we do about it? What are some recommendations we can do? Number one, I want to affirm a key recommendation in HR 1 itself, which is to have a racial justice committee within the Senate so that you have a bicameral partner and that we can make sure that every bill, every policy, every budget consideration going through the legislature has a rigorous racial and intersectional equity analysis put upon it. We also think that it's important to have an anti-racist cabinet on par with what the Children's Cabinet is doing already within Governor Walz's administration, so that every state agency can examine its own procedures, policies, and funding from a racial equity perspective. This is to, again, acknowledge that structural racism doesn't cut off neatly on health, healthcare, housing, employment. It is pervasive and cross-cutting, and we need to make sure that our approach is a structural approach that matches a structural problem. Another recommendation we have is to make sure that the generation of fiscal notes isn't only looking at the price tag of a bill or policy, but that you're embedding an equity analysis again with efficiency and effectiveness, and that equity is not treated as an amenity, but it is essential to how we consider our own policies. Another recommendation, I think I have a little bit more time. I want to make sure that we, as we have a structural approach, we center the lives and the leadership of committee members who experience structural racism. We support the formation of an interagency Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council that would systematize the engagement of community leaders. This is already
30 seconds.
With DHS, and so there's precedence and a pattern here that we can tailor. My last recommendation is to have anti-racist training and orientation for all new legislators and for House and Senate research. Again, these are upstream ways that we can embed racial equity analysis into how we make policies themselves. My finishing point here is we need to make sure that we're transforming hearts, minds, and structures. We cannot wait for enlightenment. We've been waiting for
time.
years. So let's get it done. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you for your leadership on the CECLC as the former chair.
Thank you.
A.K. Hassan and then Leandra Mitchell. A.K. Hassan.
Madam Chair, actually, my apologies. I'm not seeing A.K. Hassan on the call right now, so I think we can move on to...
All right. Leandra Mitchell and then John Teal.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Chairman Moran, my name is Leandra Mitchell, and I'm the CEO of Women Act. We advance gender equity and social justice through advocacy and collaboration, and I'm honored to testify before the Select Committee on Racial Justice. All people of color experience inequity and injustice, but women of color are disproportionately affected or impacted by systemic racism. Black girls, as early as 5, and Black women, for example, are routinely vilified for being different, strong, confident, able, and excellent. And when we face racism and discrimination, exclusion, and injustice, the onus lies on us to prove mistreatment or trauma. Current laws require sufferers to prove their suffering and to outline how their mistreatment impacts their well-being, as if a human can experience ongoing trauma and be unaffected. How is this equitable? How does this eradicate racism and racist treatment? We must change the laws that require people in protected classes from bearing the brunt of not only the initial mistreatment, but the subsequent mistreatment of reliving pain, trauma, anxiety, or depression caused by unfair and unequal legal processes. It's not enough for us to document or call out the abuses when the current system disproportionately sides with the oppressor. I ask that the members of this committee use your influence and power to partner with our coalition of individuals, nonprofits, and corporations to end systemic racism and oppression against women and all people of color. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Appreciate your being here today. John Teal, and then after John Teal will be Ruby Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Till, and I'm with the Family Partnership in Minneapolis. Founded in 1878, the Family Partnership served about 18,000 people in 2019. About 90% were BIPOC people, and 60% of our staff and 47% of our managers are BIPOC as well. Our purpose is to clear the path for family success using measurable evidence-based strategies to break intergenerational cycles of poverty, adversity, and trauma. And I'm actually here today to talk about emerging strategies to have an early impact on ACEs. We do our work through counseling, education, and when I say education, I mean early education, both therapeutic preschools and parent development through home visiting, and services for sexually exploited youth and adults. And through innovation that produces measurable breakthrough results. One of our therapeutic preschools is an anchor partner of the Northside Achievement Zone. Our other therapeutic preschool, Four Directions, is right next door to Little Earth. And we're very proud to have an excellent Indigenous language instruction partner, Wachoye Nagandikendan, as a partner in teaching children Ojibwe and Dakota languages. We know that 55% of Minnesotans have one or more ACEs, and that 24% have four or more ACEs, and that Black and Latino Minnesotans have 3 times the number of ACEs that whites do. Correction, Black and American Indians in Minnesota have 3 times the number of ACEs of white people, and Latinos 2 times the number. And at the Family Partnership, 92% of our clients have one or more ACEs, and 57%, more than twice the state average, have four or more ACEs, which is the threshold for serious health issues later in life. And a lot of those health issues are well known: smoking, obesity, alcohol use, diabetes, heart disease. But the earliest impacts of ACEs are less well known, and those are the impairment of the development of healthy brain architecture in children, and in particular, the development of executive function and self-regulation skills. The early years from 0 to 5 are the most important time frame for brain development, and in particular for the development of executive function and self-regulation skills. And that's a skill set that's all about air traffic control for the brain. It's about making good choices. It's about
30 seconds
ahead. And we have developed a strategy that we're using with our preschools that has shown very good results in giving kids a boost in executive function. So we want to encourage Minnesota to make deeper investments in this. We're very appreciative of the Medica Foundation's support, and we're partnering with Harvard Center on the Developing Child and the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting to bring executive functioning informed home visiting strategies to home visiting programs across the state. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Teal, for your testimony. Appreciate it. So we have Ruby Lee, who is next. Ms. Lee.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present today. My name is Ruby Lee, and I'm president of CLUS, in English, Latino Communities of Color, Latino Communities United in Service, sorry. CLUS was founded 40 years ago to address cultural and bilingual inequities experienced by Latinos in Minnesota. We are the largest Latino-led nonprofit in the state. Our organization serves close to 20,000 people annually in the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota. Our mission 40 years later is much more relevant today, given that economic and wellness disparities for communities of color and Native communities have increased. I'm here to ask the committee to propose legislation that invests directly in strengthening the capacity of communities of color and Native American-led organizations like ours. By investing in strengthening our organizations, we are building community. You would be building community. Instead, today, most of us community builders are asked to subsidize many times government grants because the programs do not support the capacity of our organizations to attain new staff or to attain technology and other resources that are necessary for us to expand services to our community. I've heard many times that legislators don't grant nonprofits directly, but I'd like to build a new narrative and challenge that assumption. Through policy changes, our organizations of color can be more sustainable and have become a partner with the legislature to strengthen community prosperity. Another part of legislation that we can support would be to increase intentionally programs that cultivate access to opportunities and access to financial resources for our people who have been traditionally marginalized to increase their assets. They cannot increase their assets without seed funding that can allow them to build not only businesses, but also become homeowners and become, being able to use their funds more efficiently. Also focusing investment in employment, workforce skills, support affordable housing, increasing childcare, new community-based programs, and investing in decreasing technology disparities is critically important today if we want to reduce the disparity gaps. With this investment, we will be able to really tackle racial equity. We will be able to create systems.
30 seconds.
And we want to be partners with you, but we need your support. Thank you so much, and hope to continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ms. Lee. So we have Dara Bevis and Jean Gill. Jean, you know who I'm saying, so you're after that. I don't want to mess your name up like that, Jean. So Ms. Bevis, please.
Hi. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Vera Davis, and I'm a proud resident of Minneapolis. I'm the co-founder.
A little bit louder.
Oh, sorry. Yes. My name is Vera Davis, and I am a proud resident of Minneapolis. I'm also the co-founder of Wise Inc., a publisher who specifically is working alongside Minnesotans of all backgrounds and of all ethnicities, but a large component of my work is elevating the voices of our marginalized, and that includes young voices, BIPOC voices, and queer voices. In my work as a storyteller and as a publisher, I've come to see white Minnesotans as dangerously underexposed and distant from the Black and brown communities who are here, especially as it relates to our Black Native Minnesotans who feel invisible, overlooked, and not considered in all aspects of how our institutions operate. We feel this underexposure in our art spaces, our schools, law enforcement, hiring practices across both the public and private sectors, and in our small business community, of which I am a part. We can't begin to make strides toward racial justice without acknowledging and rectifying how our neighborhoods are starved of the resources that abundantly flow to white neighborhoods. In my view, especially as a publisher, it's very apparent to me that even in 2020, our beloved community has accepted and even embraced segregation. I'm a new Black mother, I'm a job creator, I'm a taxpayer, I'm a small business owner, and I'm grappling with a very real perspective that I have to choose between an underfunded school for my child where she's not the minority, or a well-resourced school where they will not see Black teachers, admin, or other students of color. The experience for my family is a very different experience from my white friends, and this is not acceptable. And I would like all of these thoughts to be at the crux and at the center of all discussions having to do with racial equity and justice. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And thank you so much for testifying. And just want to remind our testifiers that if you would like to submit some recommendations to us, please do. And we will appreciate hearing from you and having it to record. So we have Jean Jelgum, and then Fatoum Welly. Jean, please pronounce your last name for me again.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Jean Galgalu, President and CEO of African Economic Development Solutions, AEDS, and Little Africa. It's a nonprofit organization that serves African immigrants in Minnesota. We provide a business development training program, technical assistance, lending, financial education, home ownership education, and creative placemaking, which is the intersection of art and culture for economic development strategy, and also workforce development. African Economic Development Solutions is located at 1821 University Avenue, St. Paul 55104 for your record. We are in Midway in St. Paul. Racism is a health crisis. According to the World Health Organization, the determinants of health are income and social protection, education, unemployment and job security, working life conditions, housing, early child development, social support and inclusion, access to affordable health are some of the determinants of health. So social connection, social isolation is one of the determinants of the create health issue. And through this investing in system that build social connection, like art activities, cultural-based art activity can help in improving social connection. So people get together to reconnect and rebuild their connection. So investing in art-based, as we do know, there's investment in art, but a small nonprofit or community-based art activity is not funded. So investing on art-based funding is critical and important. So creating policy that focus on 30 seconds based, and also investing on people of color CDFI. According to Dr. Corey, 2015, nearly 67% of African immigrant don't have access to loan fund. So investing in two places, investing on people of color led CDFI, and also investing in community led cultural activity is two factors that I recommend.
That's time.
To do. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Jean. Appreciate your testimony. Fatou Welly and then Keith Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members committee, a member of my community. My name is Fatou Welly. I'm the CEO of ISRUN, nonpartisan and nonprofit organization that serves Somali women and their families in Minnesota. Our approach is trust and a strength-based organization. One of our biggest goals is to help our families out of poverty. We have high female household-led, first generation and second generation that value education tremendously. What we are going to propose today is to, one issue, is to create communities of color and indigenous specific education waiver to pay private tutors to support our children who are behind right now in the school. These families are already on government assistance and will be not be hard to add to that. Let me show you a quick story of a family that is trying to get out of the system and out of poverty, but are not able to because of what's happening to private pay out of their pocket. Asha is 26-year-old Somali mother with a high school student and with less high school education. She works 5 days a week and earns $1,200 a month. Her husband works also 5 days a week. His pay covers the expensive rent and the insurances. The family has two young daughters, one in high school and one in first grade. Becoming proficient in reading and math are the biggest reporter for Somali children that is reported. The after-school programs that right now exist are insufficient and does not meet the needs for communities of color, especially the community I'm from. The cost for one subject in a private tutor is $130 per month. Asha's daughter, who is in high school, she has D average, and the mother and the parents are in a health crisis mode. And so what they're doing is hiring private tutor, and they spend $520 for the elder daughter. To prevent what's happening to the first daughter, the younger daughter, they started paying $260 per month in taking to a private tutor. This family spends $780 just to pay a private tutor so their kids don't fall behind. Unfortunately, Asha's story is not alone. This is a painful reality that many Somalis...
30 seconds.
My recommendation is to support this waiver. It's easy, and most families are already on a government assistance. I pray for you, and let's do it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you being here, Ms. Welly. Okay, Keith Baker, and then Brittany Wright. Keith or Brittany?
Yes, I'm on. I can't quite get the visual going. I'll do that here shortly.
Okay, well, we can hear you, Keith, so you can start.
Great. So thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Keith Baker. I'm the Managing Director for Reconnect Rondo. I am a resident of the state of Minnesota, having grown up in Duluth and spent the last 40 years in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Reconnect Rondo is a 501c3 organization driven to bring prosperity to the Rondo neighborhood. If we understand the history and the story of Rondo in 1930, 30% of St. Paul's African-American community lived in Rondo. This grew to 85% in 1950. At the peak, Rondoites owned homes and businesses. It was the center of the African-American social, cultural, and economic, and spiritual fabric. Then came the I-94 construction project that tore that very fabric, fragmenting the social, cultural, and economic vibrancy of Rondo. At its core, this is racism. The loss of 700 homes, no one thought about or considered or could have imagined the impact that the freeway had. And when we think about intergenerational home equity loss for African-American people, it equated to $157 million. which is extraordinary. When we put that spotlight onto this story of Rondo, college affordability, that amount could have resulted in 4,800 four-year college degrees. One out of three Ramsey County 18-year-olds or all Black children between the age of 10 and 14 at a snapshot in 2000 or a snapshot of 1980. The proposition that Reconnect Rondo is putting forward has aimed to lead a restorative movement to revitalize the African-American cultural enterprise district that was destroyed by the freeway. The preservation of history, cultural arts, entertainment, shops, businesses, housing, parks, gathering spaces, connected up by what we'll call a cap or a lid. One of the things that's most critical for us to imagine is how systems, processes, and tools impact and the convergence of those things. And so if I were to put forward a proposition and recommendation through the lens of equity and restorative justice, that all solutions offered be viewed in that way. The addition of examination and the mindfulness of the confluence of how agencies operate and the outcomes that they intend to meet that fall short because there isn't sufficient coordination at play. And so I just think that it's so critically important that we take a closer look at those implications, because they resulted in a fabric of systemic racism. And I appreciate certainly the opportunity to have this discussion, and certainly would welcome an opportunity to provide additional testimony at another time.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Appreciate your testimony. Brittany Wright, and then Deborah Stein.
All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Brittany L. Wright. I'm also a product of the Rondo community. Thank you, Keith.
A little bit louder, Brittany.
A little bit louder. Okay. Is this better?
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair. Greeting committee members and community members. My name is Brittany L. Wright, and I'm a social impact strategist with Gray Matter and the director of holistic maternal advocacy and multimedia with Trill Moms, an initiative dedicated to centering the narrative and lived experience of Black mothers through public policy, multimedia, and holistic maternal care. I'm here to testify again on behalf of Black mothers and infants in an effort to support the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act, a bill authored by Representative Ruth Richardson that addresses Black maternal mortality and morbidity. About 700 women die from childbirth and related complications each year. Black women are 3 to 5 times more likely to die in childbirth and within the first year of birth than their white counterparts. 33% of these deaths happen within the first year. And for every one Black woman who dies in childbirth, 20 to 30 more are severely injured and oftentimes permanently. I gave birth 2 years and 2 weeks ago, and I'm still dealing with the health implications of that. The primary factor for Black maternal mortality and morbidity is race, with over 60% of these deaths and injuries being preventable. When I was pregnant, I was 7 months pregnant, and I moved across the country to a new city because my husband got a new job. And in an effort to prepare myself for childbirth, I spent weeks and months researching which institution was the least likely to let my baby and I die. In a moment when I should have been preparing for life, I was literally considering the possibility of death for my infant and I because I knew the statistics for women who looked like myself. So I researched and researched, and if you're wondering if there's a magical algorithm or Google search that can protect you from dying during childbirth, there's not. However, I do recommend that it be mandated that medical providers disclose on the internet any racial bias and sensitivity training that they've taken so that expecting birth parents can make an informed decision on who they receive care from. During my birth, I developed a rare intrapartum fever. It crossed the placenta and I gave birth with a fever and my baby was born with a fever. And when the fever developed, I felt cold and I began shivering, but it led to uncontrollable convulsing. My husband yelled for a nurse to come in, and I received medicine to help my body fight the fever. But had my husband not signaled for help, I don't know what would have happened to me. I temporarily lost control of my body. And so this is why I also recommend that healthcare facilities permit partners, doulas, birth assistants, and other birth advocates into all prenatal, delivery, and postpartum appointments.
30 seconds.
Has limited those who can attend hospital visits, and it's incredibly dangerous to force mothers to receive care without the support of someone who can support them in advocating for themselves. I also recommend that it be mandated that hospitals disclose the rates of maternal mortality and morbidity, similar to the way that they report the rates of cesarean sections. The lack of transparency and the omission of the experiences of Black mothers within the media and medical field is a problem, and I recommend an increase in programs and messaging that encourage birthing justice, holistic maternal care, racial equity, and family planning. My final recommendation is that the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act also consider trans birthing parents, incarcerated women, and women facing incarceration. On behalf of the Trill Moms, thank you all for your time and joining the fight to save Black mothers. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Wright. I'm glad that you're doing well and the baby's doing well.
Yes, yes, she is. Thank you.
Okay, Deborah. And after Deborah will be Bill Keating. Ms. Stein, please introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm trying to get my video on. Is my audio working at least?
Yes, you're nice and clear.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Deborah Johnstein. I'm CEO and founder of the Unprison Project, a Minneapolis-based nonprofit serving incarcerated women, men, and youth. We provide in-prison programming and services for reentry, both in Minnesota and across the country. I lead the organization with my best efforts to reduce mass incarceration. I've been face-to-face with more than 30,000 incarcerated citizens inside prisons in 15 states, so my expertise is about the humanity and essence of the people we lock up. Before I go on, I'd like you to know my lived experience with the rippling damage of incarceration. I'm a product of the system. My birth mother had a lifelong addiction to heroin and multiple encounters with court systems in several states, beginning when she was 12. In one of her many sentences, she was pregnant with me, sentenced 6 to 10 years. So I was born in a federal prison and spent my first 12 months in a 4x6 cell that we shared. Like so many offspring of a parent in prison, I was placed in foster care, adopted into a permanent family, but no surprise, I followed her footsteps. Early childhood trauma delivers a very real lifelong impact. I'm an ex-addict and today grateful for 25 years over that of recovery, drug and alcohol free. Otherwise, I'd be a statistic, the next generation in prison. So I'm an example of exactly what's possible when resources and community engagement are in line. I witnessed firsthand how valuable human beings, mostly brown, black, and indigenous, are a resource wasted because of institutional racism and that the economics of incarceration are destroying us. A solution I recommend is a pilot program to sentence women with minor offenses to a strict program of inpatient community-based alcohol and drug treatment combined with mental health care and trauma healing. Pieces of this already exist. We have drug courts. We have diversion programs. Community engagement is a proven solution for reducing the generational cycle of incarceration. And I'm happy to make my contact info available and partner in this effect. A data-driven number needs attention. 70% of all people in prison will end up back inside in 3 to 5 years. We wouldn't accept those odds anywhere else. I mean, if every time you cross
30 seconds.
And the odds were 70%, a car would hit you, we wouldn't accept that. Or when we buy an iPhone, that 70% of the time it wouldn't work. Today, COVID-19 heightens the disparities. From a new study out of Johns Hopkins, prisoners are 500% more likely to get COVID-19 and 300% more likely to die from it. So let's close the gap in every sector and build this state and country with freedom for all. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Deborah, thank you. Mrs. Stein, thank you so much for your testimony and for your recovery and for the work that you're doing now. So we have Bill Keating and Jordan Wildermont. Bill? Mr. Keating?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
And, thank you, representatives. My name is Bill Keating, Dr. Bill Keating. I'm a longtime advocate for gifted students, but I know a great deal And I know a great deal about what we're doing. We've been bringing a bill to this for the last three sessions.
Did you put all the keys in a bear?
I'm sorry?
Oh, someone, Lorraine, Ms. Wade,
you hear me?
I think you need to mute. Proceed.
I'm on.
Yes. I can yes. See. Yes, proceed.
Okay. This is the third, this will be the third or the fourth time we brought this legislation forward. The last round we had 47 signatures, and we're coming back this year. This is a bill, as we've come to learn, it really calling for a systemic change in the education of K-12 students. This legislation addresses issues of equity, equality, and economics. We know our school-age population is changing across the state. Over half of our students are students of color. We also know that the workplace is changing, with entry-level jobs being replaced by automation and robotics. We recognize that a different preparation is needed in our schools to prepare our students for this changing world. This legislation includes an expectation that all students, K through 12, will be taught with fidelity the advanced thinking skills listed: critical thinking, creative thinking, inquiry and problem-based learning, and how to work collaboratively. This legislation also includes an expectation that all districts will have a defensible gifted program that identifies students through universal screening, which tends to be more inclusive and taps the skills and strengths of students of color, disabled students, students, just non-standard students that just don't fit the mold. This legislation also includes an expectation that all districts will be held accountable for growth in critical and creative thinkings as measured on a common instrument. This legislation includes the expectation that the social and emotional needs of all students will be addressed with comprehensive programming. And this legislation includes funding to support this initiative at $39 per pupil unit. For over a decade, school districts across the state have been criticized for their failure to close the achievement gap, and many of those efforts to address needed changes appear to have been ineffective. Districts have also failed their brightest students across the state by failing to meet the expectations of rule. Districts have been given the option to not use the money as intended and educate the brightest.
30 seconds.
I will tell you that this legislation, once passed, and I'll just tell you one thing about inquiry learning. It is a powerful tool that, if it done with fidelity, will address students' strengths and give them choice in learning. I have a website. If anyone wants that, I will post the link in the chat book. And thank you very much for your support in the past and your support in the future. And I mean, you all have a healthy future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kielty. And you can put that information in the chat for everyone to see. Thank you. Okay, so we have Jordan. Okay, there we are. And yeah. Dr. You will be Balvain.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jordan Wildermuth, Government Affairs Manager for Nurse Family Partnership, an evidence-based nurse home visiting program that serves over 1,000 moms in Minnesota. And we recognize that significant racial disparities exist in maternal health outcomes. And by partnering an expectant mom with her very own registered nurse during pregnancy, we help to identify and mitigate those risk factors. And as well as create protective factors for mom and baby against the societal challenges that contribute to toxic stress, systemic racism, and adverse pregnancy outcomes. 20-year follow-up of our program have shown that we're effective at reducing all-cause mortality among mothers and preventable cause mortality in their children living in highly disadvantaged settings. So what we're doing right now to address these disparities and to promote health equity is to improve our data collection for our program on maternal mortality and morbidity and use that data and research to inform program improvements, and then also to assess the strengths and gaps in current NFP nursing education and practice to address contributing factors. Additionally, honoring the traditional wisdom and understanding cultural values is central to the implementation of NFP in American Indian communities. We worked with local leaders, including those from White Earth and Fond du Lac, to evaluate the benefit of NFP in their communities, which resulted in adaptations to the NFP model. In response to COVID, we have been implementing telehealth for 3 years as a supplement to live visits, and then we went to 100% telehealth during the pandemic. And to support this shift, we partnered with Verizon and ATG to provide iPhones at no cost to our families to ensure clients are able to stay connected to their nurses for the duration of this crisis. And we've been able to connect 133 moms with phones during this time. Our NFP nurses conduct assessments to identify moms' concerns that could lead to poor health outcomes and assess social determinants of health to connect mom to community resources to mitigate unstable or unsafe housing, food insecurity, social isolation, and other risks. We also help moms to advocate for themselves and insist they receive the care they need when they know something is not right. This is especially important when identifying and addressing racism and implicit bias in healthcare. We would appreciate the legislature to increase investments to expand nurse
30 seconds. Leadership.
As the state faces a challenging budget situation, it's important to invest in programs with the strongest evidence for social impact and to know if dollars produce returns on investment, and also look at innovative financing structures like social impact bonds to fund some of these programs. We thank the committee for discussing these important issues and continuing to explore how we as a state address and overcome the racial disparities and social determinants that greatly impact maternal mortality. We hope to
continue
the resource as you continue this work. Thank you for your time and attention to this.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Wildermuth. It looks like next up on the panelists, we have Bao Vang. Ms. Vang? Ms. Vang, we're not able to hear your audio. You need to unmute.
Yep, I'm sorry. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the conference committee. Thank you for the opportunity for me to provide my testimony today. My name is Bao Vang, and I'm the president and CEO of the Hmong American Partnership. For over 28 years, HAP's mission is to help our communities to embrace the strength of our culture while achieving our potential by providing holistic wraparound services support to the community by moving them from poverty to self-sufficiency. We are the largest Hmong-led organization in the state of Minnesota, which we served over 25,000 clients on an annual basis in workforce, housing, education, economic development, and health. This pandemic period not only sets our community backwards, but brings to light the racial inequity that continues to hinder our state. We need a responsive government that understands racial equity work and is not afraid to champion the change. I would like to propose the following recommendation as a result of HAP's direct experience in helping families and businesses during COVID-19. Recommendation number one is systems change. There must be intentional disruption of existing systems and practices in order for Minnesota to be a true leading example of how to deal with inequity in the crisis created by this pandemic. One example that I wanted to illustrate is how the PPP program was rolled out, where it took staff 16 calls with 8 meetings in order to gather all the required documents for the submission of the paperwork. And by that time, the PPP program already ended. Recommendation number two is the redistribution of funding. We must distribute funds and resources differently from the way that we have been doing it. An example is the recent small business relief grant that just came out, where you have to be in good standing with the Secretary of State in order to be eligible for the grant. Well, as you know, in the pandemic period, state government, you know, agencies, offices are closed. And so there's no culturally inappropriate way for businesses with language barrier to renew their application, thus making them ineligible for the grant. Recommendation number three is the reinvestment in the capacity building of CBOs of color. CBOs of color is a gateway to the community, and we often are called upon or look to help create access for the community. And so community CBOs of colors are not only partners with employers, and we're also cultural brokers and have historically contributed
30 seconds
forward. Giving CBO of color a 5% administration program fee is not sustainable nor practical. The severity of this crisis required major infusion of resources to support our community, our businesses, individuals, and families. And this is not the time to refrain from putting resources where needed. And I'll just leave you with this small success story. Minnesota has led the way to create the opportunities for culturally relevant charter schools.
Time.
curriculum to lunch menus these charter schools have helped our children of Southeast Asian descent take pride in their culture and succeed academically. Taking pride in our heritage and passing on to our children is a wonderful way to overcome system racism. And I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Wing, for your testimony. Up next, we have Dr. Verna Price. Dr. Price?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all so much for hosting this event. I certainly appreciate it. I'm the founder of a program called Girls in Action, which is now renamed Girls Taking Action because that is what we are doing. We're a program of the Power of People Leadership Institute, an institute that was created by my husband and I, Brother Shane Martin Price, to really provide mentoring programs. And when I say mentoring programs, I'm like community-based, culturally responsive mentoring programs to our students. We impact over 300 students every year. 90% of our students are students of color. In these last 16 years, this is our 16th year, we have impacted now going over 6,000 students. Here's what I've learned, and I'm going to talk to you from in terms of our girls and now our boys also. We have a Boys of Hope program as well. One, our students are experiencing internalized racism. And that internalized racism is now coming out of them like never before. It's coming out of them in how they are dealing with the tragedy in our communities. I will not forget looking at the footage of downtown being looted and how many young girls were in that footage. That, what is that? That is internalized racism. Our students can no longer handle the trauma of racism that they have been dealing with for so many years. How does that look in school? That is coming out in how they act in school, how they react in school. The trauma is there. What is needed? A couple of things is needed. One, we need trauma-informed education for our teachers. Our typical teacher in Minnesota is a white female from rural Minnesota. And bless her heart, she has the right heart. She wants to do the right thing, but she just does not know what the heck she is doing. And she does not know our students, and she does not know our community. And she really does want to learn. We've got to intensify trauma-based, culturally responsive training for teachers. Two, we've got to change and look at how we hire teachers, who we're hiring, and how to retain teachers, and particularly teachers of color. We have to not only hire them, but we must continue to keep them and retain them. Third, we've got to put psychologists and psychiatrists into our schools. Our students,
30 seconds.
Our students are suffering from internalized racism, which means that they need mental health, they need therapy. And then the last thing I would want to say is make sure we put community mentors into our school. What we do in Girls in Action is we bring community mentors to the school. I will never forget a Minneapolis public school principal saying to me, we don't need the community in this school. We can handle it. Public schools, you cannot handle it. It's shown you cannot handle it. All the data shows you cannot handle it. And let the community help you.
That's time.
Mentoring. Thank you all so very much for having me on this call. I appreciate all that you're doing.
Dr. Price, thank you so much for your testimony and all your work with Girls Taking Action as well. We are very appreciative for all that you do. Moving on, we next have Mr. Joe Vitale and Mr. Carl Forsberg. Please identify yourself and then you may begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, committee, Chief of which for sharing your space with us today. As I mentioned, my name is Joseph Vidal. I'm the chair of the Native Peoples Caucus of the Minnesota DFL, and we are here in solidarity with the East Phillip Neighborhood Institute in their plans for an urban farm in East Phillip. Environmental racism is a public health crisis, and we don't need to look no further than what has been going on in East Phillip and the Hiawatha Expansion Project. This project would see the construction of a parking ramp that would store 500 cars and trucks. This is extremely problematic when you consider that 83% of East Phillip is BIPOC, and the median household income is around $32,000 a year, and the asthma rates are also the highest in the state. So East Phillip is really diverse and also very poor. And for decades, the city has exploited these two vulnerabilities by allowing corporations like the Smith Foundry to pollute the area in such a way that our neighborhood is a Superfund site for arsenic, and the soil is so polluted that it required federal intervention. To combat this history of environmental injustice, the neighborhood came up with a plan in East Phillips to create a well-thought-out urban farm that had investors, that had the state on board, but it was curbed by the city with eminent domain because they had other plans to expand that public works in that area. Again, these jobs have already been spoken for. The city will talk about how these are for jobs. It's going to create income for the area, but these jobs were spoken before the plan was brought forth by the community. So these jobs are being sent out of the area. So what community and income development really is there for the people? And so the Native People's Caucus is coming here today asking this committee to intervene and to strengthen / enforce the Clark Environmental Justice Law and pledge their support to East Phillips' proposal and help us pressure the city to accepting the people's plan. Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Vitale, for your testimony. With the remaining time left, Mr. Forsberg, did you have anything to add? Okay. Not hearing anything, we will move on next to...
Hello?
Mr. Forsberg.
Can I speak briefly?
Yes, there's a few moments left.
Okay. Yes, I belong to the Environmental Caucus, DFL. We're a statewide organization with just over 1,000 members, and we support the Native People's Caucus plan and involvement with the East Phillips Neighborhood Institute to repurpose the roof depot. This would have incredibly beneficial aspects to in terms of solar energy,
30 seconds.
Organic farming, and it is a project. Basically, the city wants to use this place as a storage place for a lot of dump trucks and earth moving equipment in an area that already is full of track and air pollution. And this is an area that has a long history of environmental degradation, and it is 83% of color. And okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forsberg, for your testimony. And next up, we have Mr. Jonathan Palmer. It's good to see you again, Mr. Palmer. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Jonathan Palmer. I am the executive director of Hallie Q. Brown Community Center in St. Paul. I'm the sixth in our 91-year history. We are an African-American social service agency open to all people in the heart of the historic Rondo community. Without criticism, as I understand that there are only so many hours in a day and a number of people who need to testify, I'd like to say that 3 minutes is unfortunately not enough time to cover the wide-ranging effects, impacts, and disparities that systemic racism has caused and had on our BIPOC communities, our state, and even our country as a whole. For Black people, we have had to reach back to 1619 when we first landed on these shores to talk about the trauma and the after effects of slavery, Jim Crow, and all that has been incorporated into our laws and practices and policies in such a way that systemic racism has been ingrained into our very fabric of our society. And oftentimes, the average person doesn't even realize it. One easy example is what Keith Baker talked about earlier in terms of the impact of the Rondo community and the highway coming through. But most people may not know that with the highway coming through, that was not the only route that was proposed. The more preferred route by the one city county planner at the time would have gone along the industrial railroad tracks and would have not had the impact that it did on the Rondo community in terms of stealing people's homes away, in terms of decimating the businesses and the organizations and committees that was there. Also, what people may not know is that people's homes were taken from them using eminent domain, and they were forced to clean those houses before the eminent domain would go into effect and they would get any kind of a payment to come out of that. And then those homes, not all of them were destroyed. Some of them were picked up and moved and sold to families that did not look like those residents in order for them to be able to make profits. And what happened from there is that we have seniors in our community that have to walk past their homes today and still see the homes that they grew up in, but given to somebody else, sold to somebody else. We have one that's worth over $1 million today, and they got $2,000 for it when the piece was taken from them. So my idea, the thing that I want to put forward to the committee is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would look at the whole impact of racism in Minnesota. Take a real good close look at what is happening.
30 seconds.
What has happened within the community, the loss of generational wealth, the generational trauma, and be able to develop policies and reconciliation measures coming out of that. Thank you for my time today. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer, for your testimony. And we agree 3 minutes is not enough time. But we also encourage folks that if there's more that you would like to share, please email that to the committee as well. Next up, I see that Attorney General Ellison has entered the room. So we will now turn it over to you for your testimony. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, and I'm very, very honored to be with you and the committee today. So thank you for having me. Shall I begin?
Please do.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I would like to urge the committee today to look into the stunning and very serious problem of institutional racism. Of course, so often when we see expressions of racial bias, they come with certain words that people might use that are offensive to everyone, or they might be expressions that most decent people or all decent people would say, that's not all right, and I identify that as racial bias or racial hatred. But so much of the racial bias that happens in our society is there's no impolite words that are ever spoken. There's no bad manners ever expressed. It's just sort of woven into the way that we live every day. And I urge you to look at that. Let me start with the pandemic. At every stage of the pandemic, we know that all people, white, black, native, all people have been affected by it and have lost their lives. But it's also true that Black, Native, and Latinx people are suffering loss of death at greater rates. And that's because of less healthcare, riskier lifestyles, greater likelihood to be an essential worker, frontline worker, and thereby exposing yourself more often because of that kind of work. What comes to mind is people who work in very close quarters, in warehouses, in meatpacking plants, all kinds of things like that. Of course, as I will say, and I'll be among the first to say, that this is a multicultural crisis and that COVID knows no color, but the circumstances of people's lives often are informed by their race, color, and background, and that has led to greater exposure for people of color. But if we come up with solutions, it will benefit everyone. Black, Native, and Latinx people are also more likely to be hurt by the economic fallout caused by the pandemic. In a recent survey, 72% of Latinx people, 60% of Black people, 55% of Native American people or households reported facing serious financial problems during the pandemic. As we know, all households are feeling stress during this time, but they're not necessarily feeling it all equally. In the area of housing, Minneapolis has one of the largest gaps between Black and white homeownership in the United States. The Black homeownership rate trailed the white homeownership rate by 51 points, a significantly larger gap than in the second and third worst metropolitan areas where the rates differ by about 40 points. Black homeownership rate in Minneapolis is 22%, half the national rate. Minnesota is ranked among the states with the worst racial disparities in home ownership in the country, Nationally, the homeownership gap is about 25%. In Minnesota, it's wider at 36%. 40% of Minnesotans of color rent cost burden compared to 23% of white households. And I would point you out to something that Jonathan was saying just a moment ago. There is a very well-documented history of racial covenants in houses. You know, the Hennepin County Museum, which anyone can go to, did a presentation on how if you were Black and wanted to own a home, there were restrictive covenants that said, you know, Black people you cannot sell this house to a Black person or a Jewish person or a Latino person. Only, and that history is there. In education, in 2018, the high school graduation gap in Minnesota between Black and white students, 23%, making it the worst in the nation. Nationally, high school graduation gap between Black and white students is about 11%, 89 for whites versus 78 for Black students. Minnesota, it's worse. You can't tell me that we can't do as well as Mississippi and Alabama, but we're trailing some of those places. Math and reading proficiency, only 30% of Black students perform at grade level compared to 65% of white students. Only 25% of Black students are college ready compared to nearly 70% of their white peers. In 2017, Minnesota had more than 200 schools where students of color made up 90% or more of enrollment, and that's more than double of what the state had in just 2002. So Minnesota's become more residentially and educationally segregated since 2002, 18 years ago. We're losing ground, which makes this particular hearing so important. Healthcare in Minnesota, Black women are 1.5 times more likely, and American Indian mothers are 7.8 times more likely to die during pregnancy and delivery in their first year post-delivery than white women. Asthma death rates are 4 times higher among Black Minnesotans. Black Minnesotans die from heart disease at 30% higher than whites. And so let me just say that I've got a lot more information here in criminal justice, wealth, and poverty, a lot of things. But let me just say, please don't just go on, you know, overt expressions of bias and discrimination. Get into the root of it. And I think that the results that you achieve will be much longer lasting. So I've been urged to wrap up, and I'm glad to submit my comments to you in writing for your consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair, and all of the members for listening.
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison, for your testimony today and for all the work that you have been doing on the front of racial justice. We appreciate you, and thanks for stopping by. Next up, we have Ms. Lorene Randall-Wade. Ms. Randall-Wade, please identify yourself and then you can begin your testimony.
Hi, it's Lorene Randall-Wade. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and other committee members. Thank you for this time. I'm Lorene Randall-Wade from Minnesota One Stop for Communities, where we provide out-of-home placement mentors to families whose children are in foster care. And in 2019, Kids Count highlights the fact that the state of Minnesota has some of the most pronounced disparities in outcomes for children of color versus white children. The experience that white middle-class children are having in Minnesota is very different than that of children of color and American Indian children. In addition, racial disparities in the number of children in out-of-home care has persisted. The number of Minnesota children who were removed from their homes and placed into foster care in 2018 is down for the first time since 2010. A state report shows that. But racial disparities in foster care and parental substance abuse remain as persistent challenges to the child welfare in Minnesota. Native American children and children of color in Minnesota were significantly more likely to be in foster care than white children in 2018. One recommendation that Kids Count makes is for policymakers to address ethnic and racial inequalities. The report shows that data shows current state and local policies undermine the well-being and success of children of color. there's a graphic floating around out in the world that shows kids on a stoop, and it's supposed to mean equality. However, equity is the means to reach equality. Equity is providing additional resources to those most disadvantaged. And we know that that is what's happening today. So that means more resources to those most disadvantaged. We at Minnesota One Stop for Communities have found the type of resources that make a difference for African American and American Indian families are those and supportive in assisting families to build strengths and protective factors. We're culturally specific and provided by someone that looks like them and understands, as well as having connections to their culture. These are the services that the state of Minnesota needs to invest in for all families. But in the case of addressing disparities, the state needs to target dollars to providers who serve families with the disproportionate outcomes in a supportive, culturally specific way. Thank you so much for all your time.
Thank you, Ms. Randall Wade, for your testimony. And looks like Co-Chair Moran is back, so I will pass the virtual gavel.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Richardson. So next we have Jamie Martinez, and then Pastor Newell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jaime Martinez, and I, just for your information, I live in District 41B, and today I am representing the Minnesota Public Health Association, or MPHA. We're a professional association comprised of over 400 members that include public health workers, healthcare providers, advocates, students, that are all dedicated to the health of all people who live in Minnesota. We're an affiliate of the American Public Health Association and have worked with Kamara Jones, who previously presented to this group, and we're certainly very supportive of her recommendations. And I won't go so deep into the data because you've heard from some very eloquent speakers in the past. So we also provided our dialogue written to you all, so you should have that with you. I won't give you a lot of data, but I will say that according to data from the United Nations, United Health Foundation, Minnesota has ranked in the top 10 healthiest states in the nation for the last three decades. But this ranking does not tell the whole story. Too many people in Minnesota are still not as healthy as they could be and should be. And those health disparities that exist are significant, persistent, and cannot be explained away with genetic factors. It is structural racism that has created some of this and also the inattention to some of the communities. You within the state all already have a document that the health department produced called Advancing Health Equity in Minnesota, which identified the social determinants of health as well as system issues that create these critical issues and problems, including structural racism. So we focused, there's so many things that we could certainly list out in terms of addressing some of the issues, but we focused on 8 or 10 of them that we felt were important. One of them is to acknowledge, for the state to acknowledge and to adopt the statement that Minnesota is on the ancestral lands of the Dakota and Anishinaabe. The Minnesota Public Health Association has done that, and we use such language in all our meetings and forums and anything that involves our
30 seconds.
Provide mandatory, rigorous, and system-wide anti-racism, anti-oppression training for all staff and legislators. And one big issue that we think should be supported, and that is appropriating funds to establish full scholarships at Minnesota Public Health Schools to graduate people from these communities, American Indian, African American, and communities of color. This is should be a committed effort over a 10-year period. Doing this starts creating and generating the public health people that we know are needed in this state, and will begin to address some of these racial inequities and racism in this state. Thank you for the opportunity, and we stand here as an association to help and assist in this effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. So Pastor Newell, and then Matt Verlich. Pastor? Okay, Pastor, if you get your sound back, we will come back to you, Pastor Newell. In the meantime, we're going to move on to Matt Verlich. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Moran and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you, and thanks for hanging in there through all the important remarks you've heard today. I'm Matt Verlich, president of the Initiative Foundation in Little Falls, serving 14 counties of central Minnesota, and coming to you remotely today from our Benton County office, which is my house. Our foundation is one of six Minnesota Initiative foundations that together serve all the counties of greater Minnesota. All six of us are involved in small business lending, but at our foundation a few years ago, we recognized that although we had helped a huge number of rural small businesses over the years, a few of them were from communities of color. So in response, we began a process of community consultation starting in St. Cloud to understand how we might better assist entrepreneurs from our East African community. Eventually, we partnered with Neighborhood Development Center of the Twin Cities and have since implemented the first Greater Minnesota adaptation of their program, which we call our Enterprise Academy. Over time, we've expanded to serve East African entrepreneurs as well as other Black entrepreneurs in the St. Cloud area. And with funding help from DEED and the legislature, we've also expanded to Brainerd, where we've been helping lower income white entrepreneurs together with members of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. And then in spring of 2021, we'll expand to Mille Lacs Reservation as well. Regarding recommendations, I'd just say it's been important for us to listen to the communities that we're trying to serve, just as you all are doing today. And in addition, talent and leadership have been key for us. And in our case, we're so fortunate that our program is run by my colleague Abdi, someone who has deep connections in the East African community and also is a successful business person himself, which equips him so well to assist other entrepreneurs. And so with that, I think I'll just wrap up and invite Abdi to say a few words about how the program operates in practice.
Okay, so why don't you follow up, since you guys seem to be working together or have worked together. Go ahead, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. I am Abdi Daisane with Initiative Foundation. Our Enterprise Academy program is a bold initiative to support low-income entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs of color to help them plan, start, and grow successful new business in our region. We build a system of entrepreneurial support that includes 12-week business planning classes, micro-lending of up to $50,000, and individualized technical assistance and support. Our micro-lending opportunity is uniquely favorable to our Muslim, Black, and Brown communities because of these two critical reasons. First, it is Islamic acceptable financing, means we do not charge them interest, as that is against their religious beliefs, but rather it's a profit-based model loan. Second, it is a character-based loan. This really gives opportunity and a second chance to the individuals who will not otherwise receive loans from banks because of their credit history. We do not only help entrepreneurs start a business, but we continue to engage and support them so they continue to succeed and make our community stronger. We do this because we believe small businesses are what makes our community vibrant and strong. And access to resources and especially capital should not be a barrier to start and own a business here in Minnesota. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your work. Pronounce your last name again for me.
Daisane, D-A-I-S-A-N-E.
Daisane, thank you so much. Okay, I see Pastor Newell is on, so why don't we move on to you, Pastor. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony. We can't hear you, Pastor. You're still muted.
Right. Now.
There you go.
How about that?
Yeah, perfect.
Thank you, ma'am.
My name again is Pastor, of course, is one of my titles. My name is Frederick Newell. I am a Section 3 advocate. I am a pastor of a church in St. Paul. I'm also the director of the Section 3 group called the Access Group. Section 3 being a federal program that Congress enacted in 1968 to fix some of the very things we're talking about here today. The federal program provides federal funds to the city of St. Paul, to the state funds we are all familiar with, like community block grant monies, homes, even public housing funds. All of these funds have a requirement set forth by Congress in 1968 that says if these cities or recipients are going to use these funds, they are directed to the cities on behalf of the low-income community, and the low-income community must then benefit from them. The jobs created, the contracts, all of those opportunities are supposed to be directed to the low-income community with priority. Unfortunately, this program is not working. So in this system, in this capitalist society we are in, that is based on worth, that's based on, or that had its inception from slavery, where we came to this point, we are still being measured by our worth. Our worth in this case is how many low-income persons are in our cities, how much federal funds can be brought to our cities accordingly, and how those funds can then generate housing and other opportunity, but then how those opportunities never stay in our communities because the program designed to keep them and directed to us fails. So we've been, as an organization and as an advocate myself, we've been pushing for this federal program for a number of years. We've even been before Congress. We've been invited to Washington, National Section 3 Advocate I am. We have pressed for this program, and unfortunately, the opportunities have yet to reach our communities. At the same time, I just got out of a meeting today with one of the council persons in St. Paul, where we have been telling them and trying to bring to their attention that we are in a time dealing with police brutality and issues around policing. The Section 3 program has tenements even in that. What is happening is the city is using the Section 3 funds or Section 3.
30 seconds.
But yet they are not complying with Section 3. That would provide jobs and opportunities and require those who use those funds to hire people from our community. So we are asking that that this state implement this program. We didn't have and show them where the state is not in compliance. So please look into the Section 3 program, and we'll be glad to give you more information on how it can provide planning opportunities, how it can give our communities the leg up we need, because it puts us in the game and gives us a chance to take advantage of how those funds are spent and how they are will benefit our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor Noor, and I look forward to you submitting that information to us at the state level. So that we can move forward on how we can best create opportunities. So our next speaker will be Jane Leonard, and then Julene Jackson. Ms. Leonard?
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jane Leonard. I'm president of Growth and Justice, a 20-year-old nonprofit that lifts up policies and practices to help create a broader prosperity for all. Over the past 2 years, Growth and Justice has been working with many partners across the state to co-create the Minnesota Equity Blueprint with an equity and inclusion lens and with Minnesota of 2040 in mind, when we will be a global majority population. The blueprint was launched in February 2020. It's available on our website, growthandjustice.org, and contains over 140 policy and practices recommendations in chapters on human capital, economic development, infrastructure, and environmental resilience, with a high priority on racial equity and other aspects of economic and social justice. In June of this year, we started work with nearly 30 organizations led by Dr. Bruce Corey and Brett Buckner, our blueprint partners, to build the Alana Community Brain Trust to together craft proactive responses to the challenges we face in the wake of COVID-19 and George Floyd's murder, and their relentless unveiling of disparities by race, income, and zip code. But ours is not the first blueprint of strategies for racial justice. I commend to you the 2014 report on Minnesota, Minnesota's Tomorrow, Equity is the Superior Growth Strategy, funded by the philanthropic community and led by PolicyLink and its founder and CEO, Angela Glover Blackwell. In the foreword, Ms. Glover Blackwell writes that the current economic model is broken and a new model hinges on how quickly we can erase racial and class divides and fully apply everyone's talents and creativity to building the next economy. She noted then, in 2014, that local action and innovation are central to building an inclusive economy. And indeed, BIPOC local leaders, organizations, and their allies are incubating the new policies, strategies, and models that can serve as the foundation for our state's new growth model. And we have local leaders here today who are doing just that, and you've heard from them this afternoon. State agency frameworks also need to be reinvented to learn from and embed these local evolutions. When many of these agencies were created, and even now with their current programs and practices, they were often based on the perspectives and needs of white men with means. I saw those barriers firsthand as a state worker in several agencies over the years. And as Attorney General and others have said, in 2020, we all know that racial inequities are deeply embedded in the state's institutions, geography, and economy. And closing those gaps will require major shifts in policy, politics, and practice at every level. So thank you for helping to champion these shifts. And I'll give my time over to the next person.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Ms. Jackson. And then after Ms. Jackson, it will be Mr. Moore, Ruben Moore.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Actually, Dr. Opsa Hassan has joined us, and we've moved him up in the list, if possible, to go next.
Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Hassan. If you don't mind, Mr. Jackson, we can follow sure. Mr. Hassan. Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay. You're still on mute, Dr. Hassan.
Okay. How about now? I think so, I'm good
perfect.
Now, yeah?
Beautiful.
All right. I'd like to thank Madam Chair Moran, who represents St. Paul area, and I am the chair of Oromo Community of Minnesota. Our community is actually located in your district.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to say it was good to see Erin Kegel. She's my representative in Spring Lake Park. That's where I live. And I'd like to say thank you to all the members who are here today. And also Dr. Bruce Corey for inviting me to speak here at the Select Committee on Racial Justice hearing. A lot of speakers before me have highlighted the social determinants of health and also racial inequalities, which are exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. I want to focus on a small clinic that we started in Northeast Minneapolis. It's called Central Family Clinic. We started it this year and launched it during the peak of pandemic in April. Originally, we were going to have a big celebration, but we decided to just launch the telehealth, and now it's a growing clinic. We actually joined Access Medical Clinic, which is located on Nicollet, and also there's a sister clinic on Lake. We primarily serve East African community. We speak Oromo, Somali, Amharic, and a lot of East African languages. And we, most of our providers are very aware of the cultural peculiarities to this group, and we serve them well. We are absolutely committed to providing patient care for all Americans, for all Minnesotans who come to our clinic. After investing a lot of my time and also resources with others who have joined us to launch this clinic, we quickly came to learn one of the biggest barriers to care is the payment system that we have in America. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows healthcare is one of the hot button issues, for many years for us here in America. And we came to learn that the large portion of our clientele, they are working poor, and they usually have the insurance bought from the market insurance, but they don't qualify for Medicare, And because they make around $40,000, oftentimes that has to pay for their rent, that has to pay for Okay, basically, the biggest barrier that we see is the MCO, and they have a lot of clout, and this compromises not the patient, but also us as providers and for survivability of our clinic. I will provide more of the recommendations in the future since my time is up, but I really appreciate you guys getting this program put together. As we battle the COVID-19. Okay.
Wrap it up. Go ahead. Finish.
Okay. I'll finish. Okay. So COVID-19 has exacerbated an existing structural problems. A lot of our immigrant communities and people that we serve have, you know, chronic diseases that are diabetes and hypertension and others that impact them. But having this vital community health clinic is important. But the structural problems that prevent us from providing easy accessibility and providing quality of care needs to be really studied and remedies provided. And I really appreciate you guys providing this platform. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Hassan is the chair of the Health and Human Service Committee and one who believes and wants to see us do a better job of supporting community clinics. I look forward to your submission so that we can have some clarity on how we can move forward on pay equity piece, right, in the healthcare system. Thank you.
Okay,
Mrs. Jackson, please.
Yes, greetings and good afternoon. It's always a pleasure to see you, Representative Chair Moran, as we were together last month at the peace celebration.
Mm-hmm.
So let me first say that, you know, when you're towards the end, you can get on at this point and just say ditto, ditto, ditto. However, I will not do that. I'd like to start with this time as we're talking about Black Lives Mattering, and some people say, well, we don't think that it matters. When you think in the one time where Black lives really mattered was during enslavement, and then thereafter, medicine and health was built on our backs as a people as well, especially Black women. I am a community servant, elder, long time in the community, and today I'm representing the Community University Healthcare Center, which is a unique and innovative partnership between the community and the University of Minnesota. And what I would like to say is that in terms of recommendation, first and foremost, is that ours is a strategy and design that folks should either continue to take note of and or begin to take note of. Because we are whole person centered, I am a long time, 9-year patient representative, this year chair, as I end my tenure. But what makes the CLUC so unique and important is because all of the health professionals have bedside manners. All of the health professionals, and I have to do a shout out to my physician, Dr. Reif, truly do put the patient in the driver's seat. They take our direction. While they are advocating and teaching us, they know that we first and foremost know what we need for our health and for our bodies and how we move forward on that. Having said that, in terms of health disparities, the huge piece with that is one of economics. So that as we look at certain people in our society, most recently being infected and a week or two later going on business as usual, we know that if in fact I had been that person, I would not have had access to the kind of care that this person had. And so that's a huge piece that continues to be connected to economics. The other piece is that when you're talking about helping people with their lot, it's important that you recognize and appreciate and value and respect the fact that they have to be the ones in the driver's seat. And so with our patient-driven board, we recognize that we have to be in the driver's seat. And so
with 30 seconds.
FQAs, that is something that we've got to continue to support. We need to support not only in terms of resources, but in terms of people. And the other final piece is that we also are instrumental in contributing to the current educational system, encouraging folks to really consider a health profession as a real profession and to move from there. And so with that, I would like to end by just saying again, health is wealth. And until we begin to really put that forward and the resources that it takes to move it forward, we will continue with the disparities that exist. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I was mute that time. So up next, we have Ruben Moore, and then Metric Giles.
Thank you, Madam Chair Moran, and members of the committee. Thank you all for holding this awesome space for our community members to share the many stories that influence racial inequities in our state. My name is Ruben Moore. I'm the CEO of Minnesota Community Care. We're the state's largest federally qualified health center, serving 40,000 Minnesotans from historically marginalized community. We're a part of a $200,000 Minnesota effort to really impact Minnesotans in a healthy way across 17 health centers like COOP. We're a part of the nation's largest primary care network, serving nearly 30 million Americans. You know, I think the diagnosis of racial injustice has been done very well by the many different testifiers on this call. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the prescriptions for some of the solutions. One is I want to look back into history, back to 1948. Our country ended World War II, and we produced the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was the European Recovery Act. In that Recovery Act, our country took $15 million, which is equivalent to $150 million today, to rebuild Germany. It paid reparations to those who were harmed by the Nazi government. It rebuilt communities. Our government did that in combination with the international effort because the world saw the injustices that occurred in Germany as a global health crisis, as a global economic crisis, as a global crisis against humanity. So I'd say the prescription for our legislators to see our legislature is to see that racial injustice from the same lens. Colonialism has caused harm to our world, and we need to approach it with a concrete economic and political effort to restore communities, both from the private and the public sector. I think we need to really mirror the Marshall Plan. It's evidence in our history. We have past precedents, and that is a key instrument in healing our communities. But it's only one element of transformative justice. I think there's many other things, as the many testifiers have spoken today, that we need to really begin to rework. As we look at deconstructing colonialism, thinking about the political determinants of health, the legal determinants of health, social, economic, how do we look to create new pathways for jobs, employment?
30 seconds.
Power, thank you very much. Shift power back to the community to allow them to navigate and guide their own ships. In restoring balance in our country. What I would say, racial injustice anywhere is racial injustice everywhere, and it is not the formula for America.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the work that your community health clinic is doing. It is really making a difference in real people's lives. So, Metric Giles.
Hello, everyone out there. I would like to extend by beginning by saying that racial justice and economic justice is very interactive. And some people do not understand that environmental justice is our health, our education, our housing, our transportation, all those things. And as it has been stated, that in Minnesota, we are at the highest level of disparities when it comes to Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And so it's very interactive. So one of my first recommendations is that while we are taking this action today, what we also need to do is stop the one step at a time and for Minnesota become a leader in purging the entire state of the imprint of white supremacy. I have not once heard the word white supremacy. And that is what has created the racism, not only in Minnesota, but throughout the state. So when I say purge, that we have 67 districts. And within those districts, how do we create an initiative that we look at all the different imprints, the statutes, the policies, and everything, and over a period of time, come and say, we must remove those, create a different narrative. So that's the one thing. And to make sure it's throughout the whole state, because this is just not an urban thing. I would like to be able to travel throughout the whole state of Minnesota. The other piece that in Minnesota, you already have the naming of peace officers. That is something else that we should also do throughout the whole state. The police, we talk about all this police reform. You cannot have the police reform themselves when, if they're the police, they will continue to police people. We need to go with what the state is saying, peace officers. So if they're peace officers, they will be motivated to keep the peace. And you cannot train people to be stop being racist. That's something that has to go with education. The last thing that people have said is the investment. We have a state that does all this pouring money into subsidies, subsidies that sustain people in poverty. Let's create it, do the same thing that we're doing for these other people that have already, which is investing. We have to stop sustaining people and come up with statewide initiatives that will be investing. So affordable housing is not a solution. Equitable housing is what we want, and affordable would be one of the values. And I would like to speak more on it, but I will send that information in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Giles. Appreciate your testimony. Okay, our next person will be Abby Motegu.
Hi, Chair Morgan, Chair yes. Richardson, members of the committee. Thank you for waiting out for me and the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dr. Abby Montagu. I'm a pediatrician and toxicologist at Hennepin Healthcare, and I want to talk to you about prenatal drug use laws and some changes you could make to increase equity and decrease waste of government resources. Hennepin Healthcare includes Hennepin County Medical Center, or HCMC, a hospital. Our mission is to serve all Minnesotans regardless of their race or income and provide a safety net hospital to anyone who needs care. 60% of my patients are non-white, and 20% prefer a language other than English. And during my work at HCMC Birth Center and my research as a toxicologist, I learned that Minnesota has some of the harshest laws in the nation regarding prenatal drug use. I'll use the example of a baby we'll call Sarah. Sarah's mom used heroin. She stopped when she was pregnant, but she didn't come to any prenatal care because she was afraid that we would report her to CPS and she'd lose her baby. She had heard friends that had been reported to CPS just because they used marijuana a few times during pregnancy and were honest about it. So she didn't come. She bought methadone off the street to stay sober, and she was able to stay sober through her pregnancy and came to deliver her baby at the hospital because she knew that'd still be safer for her and her baby. She was terrified that we'd take away her baby. I hear that from moms who use substances all the time. Baby Sarah was estimated to be about a month premature, and she needed to stay in the hospital for about 3 weeks, not because of the effects of any of the drugs her mom used, but because she was born premature. Her mom was able to be with her for about 2 days, and then when her mom was discharged, she had to go to a drug treatment program as mandated by CPS. And the requirements of her treatment program meant that she could only visit her daughter a few times a week. Prenatal care decreases the risk of prematurity. Prenatal care actually makes a bigger impact on birth outcomes and the future health of a child than any drug the mother could use. Our current mandated reporting laws around substance use in pregnancy make women afraid to come to prenatal care and afraid to be honest when they need help. We are harming babies instead of protecting them, and this disproportionately affects Black and Native American families. Studies support that racial biases determine who gets a drug screen more often than clinical risk factors. Doctors test Black babies 2 times more than any other race, even when controlled for standardized screening criteria. And a positive drug test alone in Minnesota is grounds
for
support for neglect. This exposes the whole family and the mom to individual and systemic racism. You can change this. There are exceptions to reporting marijuana use in pregnant women for doctors who take care of the moms, but not for people who take care of the babies, like me. A positive drug screen should not be grounds for neglect or make or break any case because they are unreliable tests that require careful interpretation. We are only one of three states that allow civil commitment for substance use in pregnancy, and I don't want to be known for that. You guys can make changes to help support moms and babies when they're pregnant and to make sure that we can decrease the disparities in the biases that people have when screening and implementing these policies.
Thank you so much, Dr. Menteca. I tell you, with the Family First legislation that we're doing here in the state of Minnesota, you know, I think we're going to be moving in that direction. And I know there are people who want to carry that bill. So let's stay connected.
Glad to hear that.
Yes. Farini Seal, and then Brad Lundell. That is F-R-E-W-I-N-I, last name is S-I-U-M. We'll come back to you. In the meantime, we're going to move on to Brad. Okay, Brad, thank you. You on mute?
There you go. I'll get the hang of this yet. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, and today I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Psychologists Association, 400 members that work in school districts throughout the state of Minnesota. I think a lot of the other education folks that have testified today really are going to hit, I'll hit some of the same points that they've hit. And the one that really bothers school psychologists the most is the disproportionate rate of suspensions of students of color, and also then the disproportionate referrals for special education, especially in the EBD category, that oftentimes students of color are go to those referrals at a much higher rate than the population as a whole. I think that the school psychologists do recognize, and again, there is a statement from school psychologists that's included in your packet today, and do understand the implicit bias that's prevalent in schools today and is throughout society, and certainly wants to play a major role or work with you as discussions go forward on education. Education is very important. It's not the sole, it's not the silver bullet in all of this, but it certainly is going to play a major role in increasing, you know, getting rid of some of the racial barriers that really do plague our society. I don't really have a whole lot more else to say, except I do thank the opportunity to testify on behalf of my client today. They would love to be here, but all 400 of them are working right now, and so it's hard for them to get away in the middle of the day. But we certainly, I speak for them when I say, when these discussions come up about the effects of implicit bias and the effects of structural racism that find their ways into school, we certainly want to have a voice, and they certainly want to work with you to come to solutions that will really elevate the all the social, emotional, and academic needs of the students of color. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here today to testify and stepping in for those 400 that could not be here today. We appreciate it. For Rini, you're on mute. Introduce yourself and you can start your testimony. And after that would be Sue Abdeholden. Okay, we can hear you.
Okay, can you hear me?
A little bit louder.
Can you hear me? Okay, hello. Can you hear me now? You good? Hello?
Okay, we can hear you now.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed.
And the committee members, thank you for letting us testify in this situation. And I'm a business owner by University in Snelling, by Midway. And I would have a lot of business owners, minority Black business owners, and we have.
Could you stop for a moment and pronounce and state your name again?
Farini Seyoum. Farini Seyoum. Thank you. Thank you for letting me have it. Just if I be here and we are speaking regarding representing a lot of Black business owners by University of Snelling. Neighborhood, and especially with the COVID-19, a lot of business owners there are having a problem with getting finance and support, market their businesses, and it's been very difficult for a lot of business owners there to get the fair, support from a lot of different either banks or state to run the business, to get the grants and loans. And because of that, a lot of the business owners either get to their predatory lending
And if there's any way we could get help and support, get the fair share to support the business owners there, a lot of minority Black business owners. It's been difficult to get the business running, working capital, marketing, and a lot of other business problems that are around that area. If there's any way you could help, it would be appreciated. I myself, besides that, I open up a different daycare business. Not having working capital, it's been so difficult and hard to get it going. So if you could help with the support, we would appreciate it, rather than getting to the predatory lenders, which they take advantage of a lot of business owners, a lot of especially minority business owners, not getting the loans, not getting the grant. You just get stuck in the predatory thing, and then you cannot get out of there and lose the businesses. So if we could be able to get that across, it would really help a lot.
But thank you very much. Yep, and thank you for testifying, for being here, and for staying on. And so I believe our next testifier is Sue Abderholden. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. NAMI Minnesota is committed internally and externally to advancing equity and diversity and working to promote mental well-being, prevent mental illnesses from emerging, and providing early intervention and treatment that is culturally informed and sensitive. We know that mental illnesses affect everyone, but they disproportionately impact Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other people of color. And there are many reasons: institutional discrimination, racism, microaggressions, historical trauma, and the end result of racism, such as poverty, poor health, less access to health insurance and medical care, and adverse childhood experiences. For Indigenous people, the rates of depression and substance use are high, but the trauma experienced has been high, including loss of land, culture, and language. Black people have higher rates of depression, anxiety, and sleep and digestive problems. Helen Nalville, who's a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois, calls it racial battle fatigue, which is the burden that results from regular exposure to prejudiced information, prodding regarding racial events, and people invalidating their experiences. We also know that people from these communities have much more difficulty accessing care. According to a national survey in 2018, only 43% of U.S. adults with mental health conditions are estimated to receive treatment, but that figure is 33% for Hispanic and Latino adults. We also know that when people access care, they may not receive appropriate care. For example, Black men are disproportionately diagnosed with schizophrenia with no scientific basis. Black men are more likely to be committed as mentally ill and dangerous or end up in the criminal justice system. Criminal justice systems are where people often receive mental health care for the first time, meaning there wasn't early intervention, and the trajectory of their lives have already been significantly changed. The U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Satcher, back in 2001, issued an entire report on mental health, culture, race, and ethnicity, outlining the inequities people face back in 2001. While as a community we work to end racism, we also must look at racial equity, ensuring just not the absence of inequity, but a mental health system that positively supports people in obtaining mental wellness. One area the legislature could work on is the development of a more diverse mental health workforce. In Minnesota, we have a severe shortage of mental health professionals from the BIPOC communities, and we do not have stringent educational or continuing education requirements related to diversity and anti-racism training. In listening to the barriers that are faced by people from diverse communities wanting to become a mental health professional and their solutions, we believe the legislature could make some important gains in this area. Some of the ideas are related to loan forgiveness programs, paying for supervision, paying for CEUs of BIPOC mental health professionals to become supervisors, requiring diversity training, and creating alternative pathways for licensure. The board should also be collecting demographic
30 data. Seconds.
There is, of course, so much more that could be done in other systems, criminal justice, schools, and housing, but due to time limits, I'll stop there. NAMI Minnesota would like to be seen as a resource to the committee. I encourage you to listen to a series of podcasts created by our Young Adult Multicultural Advisory Committee called Wellness and Color to learn more about mental health in BIPOC communities. Thank you for the opportunity again.
Thank you so much, Mrs. Abner Holden, for your testimony, for being here, for all the work that you do. So I believe that is our last testifier. It has been extraordinarily informative, 3 hours of information that has come from the community. I am one who totally believe that those who have been impacted by the system are those who need to be also listened to and heard, because they bring excellent solutions to the table, but also powerful stories to the table. We have about 4 minutes, and I just want to check in with my co-chair and my vice chair to see if you guys have anything you would like to share before we end, before we adjourn this committee hearing. Maybe the vice chair?
Thank you, Chair Moran. This is Vice Chair Representative Lisa Damath. Thank you for the opportunity. Again, to all of the testifiers that were with us today, live or virtually live, those that also submitted documentation to us for us to take a look at, thank you very much. We have heard so many details on how racism and as it affects our health, our healthcare system. Our education was strong and clear and loud that we are failing our students of Minnesota, and we definitely need to take a longer look at that. We've also heard how racism is affecting our environment, home ownership in the criminal justice system, so many different things, and I am grateful for the testimony today. With given this broad view and overview of the topics, again, we are going to need to dig deeper into the systems, and we have to find a way to develop positive and sustainable solutions for Minnesota. This is a great overview. Again, I appreciate those that have submitted and suggested recommendations, and I know we'll be getting more of those. But again, thank you very much for the testimony, for those of you that have taken the time to do that for us today. We will build on this for a better Minnesota. Thank you, Co-Chair Moran.
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair David. Co-Chair Richardson?
Thank you, Co-Chair Moran. I also want to thank our staff for pulling together this this testimony for today. We had a lot of moving parts behind the scenes, and just want to thank them for all of their hard work in ensuring that we had such a seamless public testimony piece. In addition, thank you to everyone who came today to share their stories and their perspectives as well. We know that 3 minutes is not enough time to dig in, and so we are looking forward to continued conversations. Please continue to submit recommendations to the committee as well. In the coming weeks, we are looking forward to digging more deeply into the recommendations and moving forward, and also looking forward to next week's hearing as well. That's going to build on some of the things that we heard about today related to the economic costs of racism. We've had a lot of informational hearings. We've got a lot of recommendations now to dig into, and so we're looking forward to that ongoing work with the community as well. Thank you, Rep. Moran.
Yep. And so with that, again, our next meeting is next Tuesday, October the 20th at 1 o'clock. And the subject that we're going to focus on is the economic, as Co-Chair Richardson stated, is the economic cost of racism. There's a cost associated with that. And so with that, there been no other business of the committee. We are adjourned. Thank you all so much for being here.